All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are streaming, and Brock, oh, actually, hold on 1 second. I always went a little step. We forgot. All right, we're waiting for attendees to come in. Just please stand by. All right, I think we're ready to go here. Ladies and gentlemen, the meeting is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Lloyd. Today is April the 14th, and we will call the San Diego Regional Water Quality Control Board to order at 9 a.m. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Dr. Barbanel?
Here.
Mr. Anderson?
Here.
Ms. Blair?
Here.
Dr. Olson?
Here.
Mr. Strong?
Here.
Ms. Warren?
Here.
And Chair Kenton?
Present. We have a quorum. Mr. Mitchell, will you please commence with your opening statement?
Yes, I will. Good morning. My name is Roger Mitchell. I am a supervising engineering geologist with the San Diego Water Board. Today, I'm serving as the remote meeting coordinator and would like to share some instructions on how to participate in today's virtual board meeting. If you wish to make a verbal comment during the public forum or during one of the board agenda items, you must be signed into Zoom webinar or be participating by phone. If you are currently watching the webcast on calspan.org or you want to comment on an agenda item, you will need to register to sign into the Zoom webinar or call into the meeting. Information on how to participate can be found on the San Diego Water Board meeting agenda website. Public comments will be accepted for each item after all presentations for the item are complete. If you wish to speak on an item, please virtually raise your hand. If you are using a computer or tablet, please use the raise hand button in Zoom. If you are calling into Zoom, please dial *9 to raise your hand. Please use the raise hand feature to let the board know you wish to speak, even if you previously registered and indicated that you wish to speak on an item. If you do not raise your hand, we will assume you no longer wish to speak. When public comment starts on an item, the commenter order will be determined by the order each person raised their hand. I will call on each commenter by name, or if you are on a phone, I will call the last three digits of your phone number, and then I will unmute each person when it is their turn to speak. Please note, you will not appear by video during your testimony. There is a 3-minute time limit for each public commenter. However, that time could be extended at the chair's discretion. During the public testimony, you will see a timer on the screen for those calling in by phone. We will run the timer and let you know when you have 30 seconds left and when your time is up. I would like to remind everyone participating in the board meeting today to state your name for the record before you speak, and please mute your microphone if you are not speaking. If you experience any technical difficulties, please call or text area code 805-801-3676 or email it@agpvideo.com. Thank you.
Thank you, Roger. Do we have anybody for the public forum? Sounds like we do not have anybody in public forum interested in addressing something that is not agendized today.
Board Chair, I do not see any hands raised at this time.
Okay, so we'll move into our board business. I'll entertain a motion for the adoption of the minutes as mailed.
So moved.
Thank you. Is there a second?
Second, Betty Olson.
Thank you. Will the clerk call the roll, please?
Dr. Barbanel?
Aye.
Mr. Anderson?
Abstain.
Ms. Blair?
Aye.
Dr. Olson?
Aye.
Mr. Strawn?
Aye.
Ms. Warren?
Aye.
Chair Cantu?
Aye. The minutes are approved. We have two informational items today. We're very excited about that. Whoops, I think I moved. I'm sorry, my screen jumped here. Now we're on item number two, the board members, chairs, and state board liaisons report, executive officers report. And shall we start with Laurel Firestone, the state water board member who is our liaison?
Great, thank you. Good to see you all here today. Thanks for having me. I wanted to start with just a couple quick updates and then wanted to update the group or the board and public on an overview of the state board strategic work plan that we adopt annually. Before I get into that, I just wanted to mention a few things that I would normally mention in my report in terms of things going on just very recently or upcoming. So we issued a statewide order around investigation of PFAS at bulk fuel storage terminals and refineries. And that was to about 161 active bulk fuel storage terminals and refineries. And that's to perform a one-time PFAS site investigation. we have a toxicity, you may remember we adopted our toxicity provisions, but we had directed a study around the C. dubia chronic toxicity test method. And we will be getting an information item from staff in May of this year to talk about the scope of work that has been under work collaboratively with stakeholders. And then we're expecting the study to be completed by December of next year. Another thing to mention is that we conducted 9 internal racial equity listening sessions as part of the Water Board's Racial Equity Initiative. That's collective with the State Water Board and Regional Water Boards. About 20% of our workforce across the Water Boards participated, which is wonderful. So that was about 400 employees. There's a SharePoint site on the internet, intranet for water boards around with upcoming updates regarding both the listening sessions, the internal listening sessions and external listening sessions, a draft racial equity resolution, which will is not quite up yet, but will be soon for discussion, I think in June, and another board workshops and action plans when they're available. So encourage folks to check that out. And just a note that I think we will have more starting in June. And I think the other thing I'll mention is that we did release on last Friday a needs assessment as part of the SAFER program, which is really significant. It's the first statewide comprehensive analysis of drinking water needs for folks that don't have access to safe drinking water now, as well as communities and private wells and state smalls that are at risk. And it has a cost estimate for those needs, as well as a funding gap analysis. It is incredibly rich with information. We just had a technical workshop to go over the results, but I'm hoping that for the next regional board meeting, I can provide some overview that's more region specific of some of that information. And we will, on our April 20th meeting, be going over a lot around the needs assessment, safe drinking water, the SAFER program, as well as drought preparation for small communities around drinking water needs. And then on the next day, the 21st, we'll be holding a workshop around temperature management, which is a big issue in the Bay Delta and kind of at a crisis point right now. So with that, I wanted to jump into the overview, but before I do that, are there any questions from the board more generally on things going on right now?
Any questions for State Board Member Firestone on what she's presented thus far? I have a question. Is the SAFER's needs assessment posted? Can we look at that? Is it in draft form and can we comment?
Yeah, it's final, but it's something that we will continue to update each year, and it is available on the SAFER website. So waterboards.ca.gov/safer. And it also has a list of the systems that are both what we call the human right to water list, which is systems that are failing essentially to provide safe water, and also the systems at risk. And those lists are things that if there's feedback from, you know, as to specific communities to understand why they may be on the list and if there's some reason to change that. There's information there on how to provide feedback around specific communities. And then, you know, we'll be holding these different workshops and continuing to iterate on the overall needs assessment each year.
Thank you. We're really lucky to have Laurel Firestone on the State Board, particularly on this issue, just one of many, but she, with a few other people and a little help, initiated the whole human right to water documentation and need. And we have a human right to water legislation today and SAFER today because of her work prior to coming to the State Water Board. And I'm sure that continues. So thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, definitely many people have worked on that to get it. But I do feel like this is extremely significant point to have this kind of statewide needs assessment, and something that certainly has been needed for a long time. All right, so maybe we can open the PowerPoint. While you're opening it, what I wanted to do was give an overview of the State Water Board's strategic work plan. So this is something we've started doing as a board, really to help provide some strategic input for management and our executive officer around what are the strategic areas we are prioritizing for each year. And we are updating this each year. So this is what was updated for 2021. We'll have a check-in midway through the year to look at how things are going and if there's things that need to be adjusted. And really the goal is not to list everything that we're working on, but to focus in on, you know, key policy priorities, and then and key areas of work that we really want to see either finish this year or get to significant milestones this year. And then within that, we've starred areas that are the very highest priority to make sure that they really get done this year, if nothing else. why don't we go to the next slide? So just a reminder for folks, the State Water Resources Control Board has a complementary mission with the regional water boards. So we have this broad mission to preserve, enhance, and restore the quality of California's water resources and drinking water for the protection of the environment, public health, and all beneficial uses, and to ensure proper water resource allocation and efficient use for the benefit of present and future generations. If you go to the next slide. And so what that means is we have a whole division of water rights, we have a whole division of financial assistance, we have a whole division of drinking water, and actually drinking water has regional offices throughout the state. We have a division around water quality, and then certainly the regional boards are really the lead in that work. And then we have an Office of Enforcement and Chief Counsel that help with compliance. Again, you know, regional boards are really on the front line of that for water quality enforcement and compliance. Next slide. So what I want to do is go through the major kind of headings, policy priorities we've set for this year. You know, as Celeste said, near and dear to my heart is protecting public health by ensuring reliable access to safe, affordable drinking water and sanitation. Much of this is really focused on the new SAFER program. We also are include in this standards, adopting and enforcing standards for contaminants, like we just adopted the total coliform rule, a revised total coliform rule, and we have starred as really hoping and top priority with staff to get through the Chrome 6 MCL development since we've been in kind of limbo for a while since the on the MCL for that. And also, this also includes a lot of the PFAS investigations and notification response level, and then source control and pretreatment for water reuse. You can go to the next slide. All right. Second, protecting and restoring watersheds, marine waters, and ecosystems. You know, that includes river and stream flows. So one of the things we've been doing with 401 certs is not only looking at the huge workload that the regions have on that, but also getting through some big backlogs we've had on hydropower certifications. We have a number of work around trying to develop environmental flow framework and looking at specific rivers where we've got ongoing oversight on orders in, say, the Carmel River and Mono Lake. We are, and both of those are ones that are highlighted this year just because there's a timing thing that we're going to need to act on this year. We are looking to ensure surface water obviously protects fish, wildlife, recreation, and other beneficial uses. So that includes stormwater work and enforcement. Like I said, there's a lot around temperature management with the Bay Delta. It also includes our ocean acidification and HABS work. And we're also looking at biostimulatory and biological integrity policies for the state. And I know this region's really been a leader in that, certainly. assisting partner agencies in around transitioning cannabis. That's something that we've been doing and has continuing to evolve. We're really looking to try to bring cannabis into the regulatory program so it can be protective of ecosystems and be sustainable. You can go to the next. Oh, well, sorry. One last thing is just in terms of protecting and restoring aquatic and marine habitats, we're highlighting the large habitat restoration permit that we're working on. We're hoping to adopt ideally by the end of the year, which is kind of a streamlining general permit for large habitat restoration projects. And then certainly our salt and sea oversight role. And we also are working to get over the finish line our section dredge mining and PVS permit. All right, now on next slide. So a big theme for us and certainly for this administration with the water resiliency portfolio is increasing statewide water resiliency in the face of climate change. This includes a lot of drought preparation work which we've been really focusing on, as a lot of the state is in really critically dry years. Increasing resiliency of local and regional water supplies. So that includes direct potable reuse, implementing the recycled water policy, and conservation. So we have a number of standards and efficiency regulatory programs that are required through statute that we're in the process of developing. And it's a focus this year. Also, in supporting sustainable management of groundwater resources. So SGMA is a big workload this year in terms of supporting both DWR's analysis of plans for areas that our programs are experts in, like water rights and drinking water, but also looking at ways we can support areas to streamline and facilitate things like recharge projects, and how we are making sure we're able to step in as a backstop if needed. Managing natural and working lands means supporting forest health, especially with forest fires, or preventing to the extent we can, ensuring healthy forests and watersheds to the given this increased fire risk, irrigated lands work, and we have a healthy soils initiative that we're supporting as well in terms of supporting compost and biosolids issues. Next slide. Oh, actually, sorry, go back one. I didn't finish with stormwater. Stormwater is a huge area in and of itself. Certainly, I know this board has done a ton on it. We are looking at how we can support. One of the big areas of focus for us, especially with our staff time and board members, is looking at stormwater cost of compliance, how to support maybe site-specific objectives, guidance for metals, which I think this region has some experience in, but trying to provide more guidance for that statewide, and cost reporting, because we recognize that a lot of times before something's implemented, the costs seem really high. And then as people start implementing it, there's ways to bring the cost down. And so figuring out how we're really understanding costs through cost reporting. And we're looking at updating the phase two permit for storm sewer systems, and just looking to support our stormwater tools and MS4 for low impact development. Bay Delta is a big issue for us. A lot of, as you've probably heard, our governor's really, really committed to trying to achieve voluntary agreements. And we've been working a ton to try to find ways to protect the Bay Delta water supply and also water quality of the Delta. You can go to 4, next slide. We've also been, a lot of focus too has been on strengthening our internal capacity and systems. So we've been able to grow our Office of Public Participation to support decisions and effective partnerships really through the SAFER program. So those positions were made possible to focus on the SAFER program, although we are recognizing that a lot of the tools and capacity there is important to help throughout the Water Board's decision making. We are looking at how to better track and communicate the Water Board's work. We have a new communications director, Nefertiti Cooley, who's wonderful, and we're working to improve our website and just tracking systems. managing our data more effectively and supporting the evolution of organizational structures, processes, and culture. That includes a racial equity initiative, fiscal and workforce development strategy. You can go to the next one. So it's always good to acknowledge what we've done in the past year. We all know it was just a huge lift just to adapt under, to do our work and accomplish our mission over COVID-19, not just for the state board, but regional boards. And I personally have just been really impressed how well staff have been able to do that relatively quickly. We established for the first time our administrative hearings office, which is focused on water rights and really helps to take on the workload and backlog a bit of things like enforcement proceedings and evidentiary proceedings and different petitions that may come up around water rights. We adopted our toxicity provisions. We really had our first adoption of the safe and affordable drinking water policy and funding plan now under our belt for the first year. We've done a lot around PFAS investigations and regulatory programs. And like I said, a big lift for us at the state board was 401 water quality certifications for hydropower projects, which we had a big backlog for. And an adoption of ELAP, which is environmental laboratory regulations, which was a big lift as well and is important not just for water, but also other environmental monitoring and testing laboratory regulations. We still have a lot to do. We're really focused on drought preparation, Sigma Bay Delta up at the State Water Board this year. That's a lot of the kind of crisis areas that are taking up a lot of focus. And like I said, we have a number of workshops coming up, already and continuing coming up this spring. Next slide. So just to get a sense of what we did is within these areas, we starred specific things. We could only do a few in each category just to say these are things that for staff in our different areas that if nothing else, this needs to get done. And already in 2021, we've done that with the revised coliform rule, which we adopted, and the winery order, which we adopted. Those were things that were just really close to getting over the finish line. So we were able to do that already this year. We started and have been focused on supporting the COVID-19 financial impacts for water systems and households and that water debt emergency, essentially, by helping to characterize the challenges in the state and then helping to inform how we can utilize the federal funding for relief around that. So that's something that's ongoing. We're still waiting on, we have about 100, we're estimating that the state will get about 100 million in potential debt relief funds for low-income households and the relief packages that have already been passed, we're still waiting on the feds to provide guidance on how we can administer that and the exact amount. But we're working to make sure we're ready and that we have our own recommendations on that. And we're looking to hold a public workshop with stakeholders around that in May or June. Top priority, like I said, is Chrome 6. We've just been in limbo too long, and I know people want some certainty around that as we've, there was the MCL adopted, then it was overturned by the courts. And so back to us to adopt so that water systems can move forward and folks can know what legal limits are. Temperature management, we have a workshop coming up, but a lot of that is really Sacramento River and salmon and other fish species focused and just trying to prevent mass mortality this year. Direct potable reuse is something that we are focusing on staying on track for. We have a deadline of 2023, and there's a lot of milestones there. So that's a top priority not to get behind on. Like I said, there's a lot of also milestones around conservation regulations as per requirements by the legislature. So in particular, right now, we're working on water loss standards, and then are working ultimately to have efficiency standards and objectives as part of an overall conservation regulation. SGMA is a big focus. Like I said, for us, stormwater, we've been looking at how to support cost of compliance issues. We're really trying to get the construction stormwater permit over the finish line. And again, I know this region has been a leader in some of the methods around, particularly around monitoring enforcement. Bay Delta, again, a big priority. We have SAFER is the drinking water area piece of work. And, you know, I think this needs assessment helps with this overall. How are we communicating the needs out there and the tools that are there and supporting that communication and partnership? Data management is very important to accomplishing our goals. And, you know, as you probably know, staff throughout the water boards rely on really outdated data management software that makes it much more staff intensive and limiting in terms of how we can use data within our work. And so that's continues to be something we're looking at how to develop resources for and support for. Our racial equity initiative, which like I said, we're hoping to bring there's a large work group effort across the water boards, including the regional boards and state board staff. And we've held external listening sessions as well as internal and are hoping to bring a draft resolution both to our board and regional boards for consideration as to whether we want to adopt a resolution on that. And then also working through a more strategic work plan on what that means. Fiscal remains, you know, our accounting and fiscal challenges. We've gotten through the worst of it, but we still are really working on trying to make sure we can get money out and accounting done as quickly as possible, despite this software change that made it very difficult. Workforce development strategy to try to diversify and support our workforce, and HR Center of Excellence is something where we're coordinating with other CalEPA agencies as a priority as part of our overall with our sister agencies as part of CalEPA. Next slide. That's it. So I know that's a lot, but I would be happy to answer any questions. And again, really the goal here was just to give an overview of what we do, what we're focused on, and what direction our board has given to our staff around priorities for this year, checking in again midterm. We'll be checking in with them in the summer and then adopting a new one for 2022 at the end of this year.
Thank you, Board Member Firestone. That's great. We know that climate change is woven into all of those priorities.
Absolutely.
And like to reiterate our EO's comment that we would like to see cross-border flows somewhere embedded in there, if not in the highlight priorities, but at least in the written materials.
I think it's a good point. And I'll just say on that, certainly it's not to say that we're not doing work on that. And I think to some degree that oversight, which I will, discuss with for the next round is a reflection of just the leadership of this region and Region 7 in their border issues of just, being the real leaders in that front, which is a huge priority, and glad to be supporting it.
And that's a good point, that our priorities are a different granularity and a different focus by definition, which is the reason we have 9 regional boards, is for the ability to customize and be responsive and focus on the priorities of each of those different watersheds. So while this is the state's priorities and we really appreciate them and we see how we fit under that umbrella, we still have our own priorities that we articulate and put our resources on. Any questions or comments from the board members for board member Firestone?
Laura, I'll have a quick question if you don't mind. As we hopefully, you know, continue to roll out the vaccine and move back to quote unquote normal, it would be interesting to hear at another meeting how State Board is looking at best practices that were developed as we did these remote meetings or as we reached out to stakeholders remotely so that we don't lose that point of contact. It would just, I think, be nice for us to hear what you all are doing or lessons learned so that we can think about that going forward as well.
Yeah, it's a great point. We're really hoping to keep a lot of the benefits that we've had as kind of silver linings with this crisis. And just a note on that is that we're not alone in this challenge, but there are Bagley-Keene barriers to being able to have a totally remote meeting and notification requirements. And so that's something just the legislature is looking at this year, because I think we've found so many benefits, not just with our agencies, but others, of enabling remote participation, as part of the ways to encourage and facilitate participation in these. So definitely, we'll get back to you on that. I think it's very much a work in progress, but I think we're all on the same page of let's keep the good stuff. Don't lose that.
Thank you, great point. Vice Chair, Dr. Olson.
Okay, make sure I'm not muted. I just had one question. It was about looking at cost for and source control for water reuse. So one of the problems that I've heard about in our area are wastewater treatment and the chemicals that are used, because a lot of the chemicals are proprietary. And so if you're running a plant and suddenly for some reason your PFAS or your PFO come up or increase during your plant, and then you go back to try and, well, are we using any chemicals? It's proprietary, and so it's problematic. I just wanted to know if the state's looking into something like that and going to facilitate ease of getting information.
Yeah. So we have, and within our first priority areas, supporting source control and wastewater pretreatment programs for emerging contaminants of concern to protect recycled water uses, including direct potable reuse. So it's definitely on our radar, looking at how to not so much, I think, for that area, cost of compliance, but more just how to support addressing that issue of pretreatment program and emerging contaminants of concern so that we can continue to both protect public health, but also encourage that kind of use of more resilient supplies.
So you just might, raise this issue. So you're looking at pretreatment right now, but in treatment, I can't tell you the number of plants that I've heard that the values just go up through treatment. Mm. And so, that's sort of distressing, because if you have to go through and kind of, do like you do with diet and remove the chemicals, and because the chemicals that are used oftentimes are to make sure that your suspended solids meet the discharge standards, and they're simply coagulants.
Okay, great. I'll bring that back.
Thank you. I greatly appreciate that.
Thank you. Board member Dr. Arbarnal.
Actually, it's Henry. Thank you. Laurel, I am interested to know what plans the State Board has to work with the regions on educating the board members and staff on the actual status of the science of climate change so that our decisions, recommendations, and actions connect with the actual science.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as you know, we've been trying, this is looking at how we can support specific positions on climate change has been difficult in terms of resources. But I think where we're focusing is looking at how within each of our programs and regulatory programs that we're able to bring in the best science we can in supporting development of those. I understand that's not exactly what you're asking, but that's where a lot of our resources can be put to use. We are, for example, we just released a climate change report specifically for water rights. And a lot of that is looking at, you know, how do we provide tools and pathways for water rights holders to factor in climate change within their permit requests? So, you know, again, it's the impacts will be different in each program area and each region of the state. And it's something, you know, so for example, on the water quality side, we're looking at this kind of large scale restoration general permit. And that's another area where we don't want to be supporting programs for restoration that won't be able to be sustained with climate change. But also that's a huge a strategy in trying to support more natural resiliency programs and projects. So, you know, I understand that's not exactly what you're asking, but that's really where our resources and
it's not exactly, but it's very close. And I think it highlights the direction that my question was at. And I have a suggestion.
Great.
Is it possible for the regions, it's easy for Region 9, actually, to work closely with SQRP, the San Francisco, SFEI, San Francisco Estuary Institute, and academic climate scientists at Scripps Institution of Oceanography, the Monterey Bay Aquarium. There's a research institute in Monterey. I forgot its name. And I don't mean to be parochial about Scripps, but they're also experts at UC Davis, for example. Is it possible to support an activity that contemplates and brings to the water boards as a whole the information about what we can do, what we can't do, and how much it'll cost?
Yeah.
I'm not very impressed with the discussions that take place in the Los Angeles Times or the Washington Post. They tend to be kind of short on science. And I think California deserves better than that. And what can we do to take the leadership on that?
Yeah.
Cantu and Henry and Barbanel, if I could jump in, please. We actually were able to organize with State Board and Regions 4 and 8 and SQRP a series of symposia last summer, even during the pandemic, in which we talked about some specific areas of climate change as an introductory course, if you will. That was an excellent start. But I think, Henry, that it would be really beneficial if we were able to fund that kind of an effort on an ongoing semi-annual basis and be able to invite in some of the leading researchers from around the world on the subjects of ocean acidification and so on.
Right.
It was very informative and very well done. But we need more than just a one-time ad hoc effort on that, I believe. And I think that the opportunity exists for State Board to identify contract resources or other interagency agreements with SFEI and SQRP that would allow us to carry on that kind of educational right. effort. Very valuable it was.
Thank you, Dave.
I think the Academy is also going to be an opportunity. The Academy is one of the new priorities that Board Member Firestone highlighted. And that's an opportunity, a channel. I mean, the research is being done. It's just the delivery of it in a way that our staff and board members can embrace it and absorb it and incorporate it. So I have high hopes for that.
Which academy is that?
It's this. It was one of the priorities. It was one of the last priorities that board member Firestone just mentioned.
There's a, we have a training academy around workforce development and in different areas that can also help. It's also not just available to staff, but also for board members. So happy to make sure that, or just circle back to find out, to the extent we are including pieces of that and how to make sure that's more robust potentially and then available, clearly available to board members as well as staff.
Could you send us specific information on this academy, what it does, how it does it, and whether or not it intersects with the need for what I'll call, the lawyers call it continuing education at the bar. I call it continuing education on environmental effects of climate change.
Yeah, and it absolutely, I will.
Thank you.
And again, I think what we're also, in addition to that overall piece and statewide and regional piece, I think certainly within things like our ocean acidification work, that's the kind of thing we're trying to look at, bring in the science and different experts out there to support the best policy making we can in these more specific areas.
Okay, thank you very much.
If last call for questions for our state water board member representative. I really want to thank you for that presentation. I can really see that we've moved so far. Historically, the state water board did a 5-year strategic plan, which was, robust and very thoughtful, put a lot of energy into it. And that was rolled out to the regional boards as an informational item. But this is an annual plan. So it's really, it's going to be much more energy efficient in that it's going to communicate real time priorities. And we really hope that our drought that we've already recognized is not going to throw us off or have another crisis or fire or whatever it might be to throw us off. I think it takes 3 things to throw us off, and we always have 2. So we will be able to implement that. So thank you very much for that very detailed report, and we really appreciate you joining us today.
Great. Thank you. And thanks for the feedback. And I will follow up on the things that we discussed.
Now's the time for board members to share any ideas, questions, and reports that they've been up to for the last month. If anybody has anything, please raise your hand.
Okay.
Vice Chair, Dr. Olson.
I just wanted to say that we're in my area, the Santa Margarita Water District received over $6 million to do a stormwater capture and infiltration in the upper basin. And then that water will go into a drinking water plant. So with eventual plans, hopefully, that recycled water can be put in during the dry months. But this is the first phase, stormwater capture. And everyone in that area is excited and grateful for the help. And it will, in the first phase, supply 1,000 acre feet of drinking water, which I know isn't very much compared to clean water, but then our population isn't as large and we have some different issues. And I know there are many, many helps it for this grant money, including the regional board. We just want to thank the area wants to thank everyone for their help. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Anyone else? You can raise your real hand or your virtual hand. Okay, well, I'm going to ask our Executive Officer Gibson if he has anything to add on his Executive Director report, or if the board members have any questions for him on that report. It's a very comprehensive report. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Cantu. I'd like to ask the board to join me in congratulating Christina Arias today as our newest Water Resource Control Engineer in the Enforcement Unit, an excellent addition to that unit. And I'd also like to ask you to join me in congratulating Amy Grove on her promotion to Senior Engineering Geologist overseeing the Site Restoration and Ag WDR Unit. And one of her first jobs will be to fill Christina Arias's very large and very professional shoes. So we're very glad to have both of them in those capacities, and we are now seeking to fill an additional vacancy in the MPDS unit. And if there aren't any other questions, that is my report for this month. Yes, Board Member Warren.
Member Warren.
I just couldn't tell from the March 15th letter that was included in your executive officer report, Dave, Mr. Sawyers, and Mr. Torres. It didn't look like our local elected officials were copied on that letter, and that's a correct assumption. Is there a thought process or a reasoning behind why they were not sent a copy?
We actually did share the letter broadly with those officials, and we actually met with them on Monday to discuss the letter.
Perfect. Thank you.
Anyone else? Okay, let's move to our two informational items today. The first one is sediment cleanup and Navy dredging update for the San Diego Bay. Mr. McLean will give us a report. I see you there.
Good morning, Board Chair Cantu and members of the board. My name is Sean McLean. I'm the Senior Program Manager of the Site Restoration and Military Facilities Unit. I'm excited to give you an update today on the sediment cleanup projects in San Diego Bay. This is going to be a joint presentation from Water Board staff and from the Department of Navy.
Sean, real quickly, you're sharing your notes slide and the next agenda slide instead of the presentation mode.
I apologize.
No problem.
Thank you. Let me start
You're
over.
You're welcome.
Live TV, isn't it? Let's see. I am not seeing my presentation. I'm sorry.
Does anybody else have the presentation and you could coordinate with them?
Yes, I believe Roger has it available.
Would that be a good solution,
Sean? I think I've got it. Let me see if I've got it here. There we go. Great. I got it.
Great, thank you.
I
beautiful.
That's good, thank you.
Now the question is, can you see your own notes?
I can see my notes, thank you. So first today, I'll review the progress of the sediment cleanups since the last bay update in 2019, and one of the tools that we use to evaluate sediment contamination in the bay. Kristen Schwall, a Water Resources Control Engineer for the San Diego Water Board, will provide an update on a memorandum of agreement that was developed in collaboration with the Navy that establishes requirements for military dredging projects in the bay. From there, the Department of Navy will discuss its maintenance dredging plans, its monitoring programs, and the emergency response actions that occurred during the USS Bonham Richard ship fire. So let me start off with our strategy in the bay. Any project under regulatory oversight in the bay starts with the strategy for a healthy San Diego Bay as adopted by the board in June of 2015. The strategy guides board staff when prioritizing projects and taking actions to protect and restore the health of the bay. I'm not going to go over all the details in the strategy, but I would like to highlight step one out of the seven steps in the strategy. Step one recognizes the key beneficial uses and key areas for San Diego Bay, which are recreation, fish and shellfish consumption, and habitats and ecosystems. Polychlorinated biphenyls, known as PCBs, are one of the main pollutants of concern in bay sediments that can severely impact the fish and shellfish consumption, key beneficial use. And in my opinion, if you affect this one, you're going to eventually affect the habitats and ecosystem and the recreation. So all three could be affected to some degree. At the last bay update in 2019, Wayne Chu gave a great demonstration of the Data Information Visualization Tool, or DIVIT for short. Now, the DIVIT is a GIS tool developed by Wayne that helps us visualize data and information so we can try to see what the most important issues are and the most important areas our programs should focus on. This is an aerial photo of the bay. It's a snapshot from the DIVIT program, and the colored dots represent the data we have for PCBs detected in sediment up to the year of 2017. The green and yellow dots are areas that generally should not be a concern for PCBs, and the areas with a lot of magenta and red dots are areas of concern for PCBs and is where the Groundwater Protection Branch has focused most of its efforts on assessments and cleanups these last few years. So let's start on the northern side of the bay. This is where there has historically been a lot of land-based industrial facilities, and almost all of the PCB-impacted sediment in the northern part of the bay are detected near the storm drain outfalls. There have been several projects completed, shown in green, that I'm not going to cover today. And if you can see my cursor, I'm pointing to one by the Convention Center. There's also a couple more over here by just beneath the San Diego Airport. And there's a few over here in this cove. These were covered in previous updates. So let's start with the Navy's Boat Channel project that was completed in 2018. This is where portions of the channel were dredged, mainly to remove metal exceedances in soil, but some PCB contaminated sediments were also removed as part of this process. This work was completed in accordance with CERCLA requirements and a record of decision that proposed the dredging of the sediments in portions of the boat channel. The Navy submitted a remedial action compliance report that demonstrated remedial goals were achieved. For the Tow Basin and Lockheed Terminal of East Arbor Highland, the site cleanup program issued a cleanup and abatement order in 2017 that required cleanup of contaminated sediment. The San Diego Water Board approved the feasibility study for the site in September 2020. The feasibility study proposes limited dredging with the majority of the site to be covered with a 6-inch sand cover to provide a physical barrier to contaminated sediment that is not proposed to be dredged. A remedial action plan and post-remedial monitoring plan are currently in development. At the Laurel Hawthorne embayment, three separate investigative orders, or IOs, were issued in 2019 to multiple responsible parties. Work plans for each IO were approved by board staff in February 2021. It is anticipated that the work plans will be implemented by this summer. But as you can see, we are starting to get good coverage on the northern side of the bay on the areas that need it the most. Now, if we move to the central and southern portions of the bay, this is where most of the shipyard building and repair activities are located. Starting with the central portion, there are three projects near Coronado Bridge, and they all seem to be following the same timeline. Three separate investigative orders were issued in 2017, one to the 10th Avenue Marine Terminal, one to the Continental Maritime of San Diego, and one to BAE and SDG&E. Assessment reports were submitted to the board in 2019 and 2020, and board staff are currently evaluating this data and looking into additional investigations that will be needed. The next phase of investigative orders for these projects will be issued by this summer, and the additional assessments may be completed by the summer of 2022. South of this area, we have the shipyards, where NASSCO and BAE completed remediation before 2017, and assessments are still ongoing to assess the effectiveness of the remediation completed in these areas. And south of the shipyards, you can see there are a lot of red and magenta areas that need to be addressed. This is the Naval Base San Diego area, and the Navy will provide us with an update in a few minutes on all of its planned maintenance dredging projects in these areas. So just to highlight the accomplishments in San Diego Bay over the last few years, one Navy cleanup project was completed. The site cleanup program issued one cleanup and abatement order and six investigative orders, with more orders to come soon. This is all great progress for the last 4 years, and I can't wait to see what happens in the next 5 years once these projects are completed. Now I'd like to turn it over to Kristen Schwall to discuss the memorandum of agreement that was developed in collaboration with the Navy for its maintenance dredging projects. This MOA was developed to ensure consistency with the requirements of the 401 program. Kristen?
Good morning. My name is Kristen Schwall. I'm a water resource control engineer in the Site Restoration Military Facilities Unit. I am here today to talk to you about a Memorandum of Agreement, or MOA, that the Water Board and the Navy have been collaborating on to address maintenance dredging by the Navy. Maintenance dredging is mandatory to maintain a proper clearance for Navy ships. The Water Board and the Navy have had extensive meetings on the topic of dredging at all levels of staff, from technical to management level. Next slide. This MOA establishes a consistent set of requirements for navigational maintenance dredging by the Navy in San Diego Bay for areas with contaminated sediment. The Navy has significant maintenance dredging efforts planned over the next 5 years, and some of these dredging projects are in contaminated sediment areas. The MOA applies to all bases on San Diego Bay, including Naval Base San Diego, Naval Base Point Loma, North Island Naval Air Station, and the Naval Amphibious Base. The Silver Strand Training Center is also shown on the map, but due to its southern location in the bay, dredging is unlikely at this base. The main goal of the MOA is to reduce the dispersion of contaminated sediment from dredging projects in other areas of San Diego Bay by establishing best management practices and monitoring requirements. This standard set of requirements will facilitate Water Board issuance of Clean Water Act Section 401 water quality certifications for these Navy projects. It will also simplify Navy contracting for projects, since they know what the requirements will be in advance. Next slide. Best management practices required by the MOA include the use of the environmental clamshell dredge, which will minimize sediment escaping the dredge during the process. Silt curtains are a permeable geotextile curtain installed in the bay to minimize the amount of sediment which drifts offsite during dredging. The MOA requires a double silt curtain around Navy dredge sites in contaminated areas. A clamshell dredge and double silt curtains were used by the Navy at the cleanup of Naval Training Center in the Boat Channel in 2018. Eelgrass habitat is important in San Diego Bay, and the MOA includes provisions to protect it. The MOA includes an onshore sediment controls to prevent the release of contaminated sediment during onshore sediment processing. Nothing from the onshore processing area is allowed to be discharged to the bay, including drifts from offloading process, dredge water, storm water, and truck tracking sediment. Next slide. The monitoring requirements are designed to determine if the best management practices are effective. If a release is detected, the Navy is required to take action to eliminate the problem. Monitoring includes water quality samples, as well as visual monitoring. There will be a qualified environmental monitor on site with the authority to stop work if water quality standards are exceeded. Z-layer sampling is required to estimate the sediment quality exposed in San Diego Bay after dredging is complete. This is generally accomplished by using a core sample collected before the dredging and analyzing the bottom 6 inches. If the Z-layer sampling estimates that contaminated sediment would be exposed during dredging, the Water Board and the Navy can determine what measures to take to avoid exposing this contaminated sediment. This MOA provides a consistent approach with the Clean Water Act 401 certification program. It will ensure that the Navy is using the same requirements as other dredging projects in the Bay. Now, I would like to turn it over to Mr. Jason Golumski-Jones, Navy Region Southwest Fleet Environmental Director for the Department of the Navy.
Good morning, and thank you for the introduction. And thank you, board members, for this time to be able to share with you many of just a few of the things the Navy does to ensure clean water within our region. I want to make sure I have a sound check and everyone can hear me before I pontificate and no one hears the great words I say. I'll guess that's a you can hear me.
Yes, we can.
Yes.
Excellent. NAVFAC System Command, Naval Facilities Engineering Command, in coordination with Navy Region Southwest, is responsible for all aspects of shore infrastructure for and any Navy operations within that envelope. This duty requires our regional commander, Admiral Bette Bolivar, and all of our installation commanding officers to ensure environmental compliance and conservation for the land and the water surrounding the installations throughout California, Arizona, Nevada, New Mexico, and Colorado. To manage this requirement, the Navy employs a team of talented scientists, engineers, planners, and other environmental professionals to protect and preserve resources while ensuring our mission continues. We also team with contractors, resource sponsors, regulators, local universities and research institutions, and members of the community to ensure the program is managed appropriately and to the best of our ability. It truly does take a village. At this time, I'd like to introduce the rest of the team that is going to be speaking today. I have with me Mr. Daryl Van Winkle, who is the Environmental Restoration Program Manager, as well as Mr. Walter Wilson, who is the Fleet Marine Biologist for the region. Next slide, please. During today's presentation, Daryl will talk about sediment cleanup and investigations, as well as maintenance dredging. I'll come back and speak about the BHR fire, as well as some water quality improvements we have done. And Walt will close us out with regional bay enhancement projects. At this time, I'd like to turn it over to Daryl to talk about the sediment cleanup. Next slide, please.
Hi, thank you, board members, for allowing the Navy to talk today about our various subjects. As Jason mentioned, I am the Environmental Restoration Program Manager for NAVFAC Southwest, which is really the cleanup manager. So I'm responsible for both terrestrial and sediment cleanups as needed for the active military installations. We have others that support with the base realignment and closure. In advance, I'd like to apologize. There's a lot of words in the slides, a lot of Navy vernacular and our own particular use of acronyms. And I've tried to define them where I can. Hopefully I've caught them all so that I'm not using things that are expressions that people are unfamiliar with. But I also want to say there's a lot of words on these slides. I want to focus on kind of some of the highlights in the interest of time. One sediment cleanup I wanted to talk about happened over a long period of time, a number of years ago, at Naval Air Station North Island. It was what we've termed as Installation Restoration Site 1. We broke that cleanup project, sediment cleanup project, into two what are known as operable units under CERCLA. We had operable unit 1A and 1B. 1A consisted of almost all the outfalls that you can see highlighted in the blue color around and half circle shapes around the outside as long. And in addition, in the wedge shape area there, there were 15 total outfalls that were dredged. Removed about 78,000 cubic yards of contaminated sediment and consolidated them in a confined disposal facility, which is where that wedge-shaped unit is. That was capped with clean fill and placed over the removed sediment. It's since been paved and is used by the Navy as kind of a pier area. We've also sampled since that removal. We sampled a number of times at those outfalls to make sure that there wasn't continued contamination from the operations. Any of those storm drains that would have contributed to that are no longer sending industrial waste and such that might have originally been discharged in those areas. And so we have not seen any evidence of contamination. And in 2015, we got no further action in working with the water board staff and the water board and the California DTSC at those. So there's a record of decision for that. And then finally, there was one other additional outfall kind of at the very southern edge. It's kind of hard to see, but that was outfall 16. We worked with the staff there to get a no further action letter for that additional outfall, which was under operable unit 1B. Next slide, please. I just wanted to mention briefly, there have been a couple other cleanups with sediment in the San Diego Bay. A smaller one was conducted at Naval Amphibious Base at a number of IR sites. And these IR sites were primarily terrestrial, but had a sediment component to it. And so in 2016, the sediment portions of those sites were closed out with a rod. Which requires some additional, continued monitoring as portion of that closes out. And then Sean already talked about the Naval Training Center boat channel. That was done under our base realignment and closure program. And that has been closed with the Water Board's acceptance of the remedial action completion report in 2019. So no further action is required at that site. Next slide, please. Also wanted to talk about some of our investigative efforts. You know, through a number of discussions with your staff over the last couple of years, we've talked about the focus and some need for some sediment investigation down in the area surrounding Naval Base San Diego. As part of that, we have to implement Navy policy, and there's a document that's required to be produced before we do any kind of additional work in a sediment contaminated area, which is known as a watershed contaminated source document, where we have to look at all sources that might contribute to the sediment contamination in that area. That was completed in 2020, and we are now moving on with the next stage in the CERCLA process in trying to do some further investigation. The good news is that there's been, a number of dredging in these areas to clean up that some of the existing contaminated sediment in those areas. And I'll talk about that in some further slides. But, we are going to go out and investigate along the entire Naval Base San Diego waterfront to look at any additional contaminated sediment, and we'll be working closely with the Water Board staff as we work through that process. Also, just wanted to mention there is another site associated with Naval Base San Diego. It's what we include or call our Munitions Response Program, and this one is known as Munitions Response Program Site 100. I know that munitions conjures up in people's minds bombs and large explosions. And certainly that is a consideration, one of the reasons that we have to be very careful with these things. But munitions actually cover a wide range of various sizes of things, anywhere from, smaller shells all the way up to larger bombs. And I just wanted to point out that, through our dredging operations, we've been able to recover some items around Naval Base San Diego, which are shown in the pictures on the right. And all of these are items that have not been explosive in nature. Ultimately, they've been determined as a material deemed as safe. And we do all these evaluations working very closely with the Naval Specialized Ordnance experts to make sure that, you know, we're not creating any kind of situation where there would be a threat to the public or our sailors on the base. Just quickly working through that history, we've done a number of investigations over the since 2010. One of the things that has, you know, big Navy has kind of told us is that sediment cleanup work and even sediment investigation work can be, you know, very expensive, and especially when it comes to munitions. I have a slide that I'll show coming up here in the dredging portion, but, you know, there's a lot of metallic material that is in the bay. And, you know, as part of trying to do munitions evaluations, you have to use very specialized geophysical equipment to try and detect where those munitions might be. And that, the unfortunate thing is that, you know, additional metal items that are buried out there set off signals just like the munitions do. And so one of the things that the Navy's really been working at is using advanced sensing technologies to try and focus in on those areas that might be the most likely to have the munitions portions. And so we've done a couple pilot studies just in the last couple of years. These are highly specialized and very classified sensing technologies, and so they're difficult to try and get out there to use and do these pilot studies, but they have proven to be exceptionally well advanced in terms of defining those areas that we probably need to focus on. And then, just, you know, as you can see, these munition items that we have removed from the site through recent maintenance dredging, have been smaller items. We haven't really seen any large items and items that we've had to consider that have been fused and a danger. Next slide, please. So I'm going to switch now to maintenance dredging. There's been a lot of dredging in the bay in general over the years from the 30s on, and also around Naval Base San Diego and some of the other bases, as have been mentioned by Kristen and others. You know, this is a really needed to maintain safe navigation and berthing at our piers, especially to meet the mission requirements that we have. The dredging frequency can happen at a wide variety of years. We've done quite a bit recently, which I'll talk about. But prior to any of the dredging, we do have to collect samples, and we submit those through the permitting process through the Army Corps of Engineers and work with EPA. Your staff are involved through the permitting process as well in terms of defining where those materials would be suitable for disposal. And, when it comes to disposing of those sediments, we have a preferred order of preference for where we do dispose of it, either beneficial reuse if we can, or ocean disposal out in EPA's LA5 area, or if the sediment is just, you know, contaminated and it can't be disposed in those two areas, we tend to dispose of it in what we call upland or landfill disposal. Next slide, please. So I had had some other slides that had provided a little more detail on the areas, but I just want to point out that the primary areas that I'll be talking about with dredging are Naval Base Point Loma, Naval Base San Diego, and Naval Amphibious Base Coronado. They're identified there. You can see a lot of the piers just to help orient a little bit. At Naval Base San Diego, the piers start at Pier 1 and they go down to Pier 16 from north to south. There's a bunch of different fueling piers around Naval Amphibious Base Coronado. You can kind of see them sticking out there. And then over at Naval Base Point Noma, I'll be referring to what's known as Arco Pier, which is kind of the bigger one that you can see sticking out of the peninsula there. And then the one just north of that is what's known as the 5000 Pier. Next slide, please. So over the last 5 years, again, there's a lot of words on this page. And as you can see, the various piers that are done at any time or are dredged at any particular time kind of overlap. And I know it's hard to kind of make or understand how or why we might've done this these different dredgings at different times. I think that the point that could be made is that they're probably sequenced in many ways because of mission requirements and or because, you know, we've discovered that sediments had accumulated in those areas and really needed to be removed. So we've done this at Naval Base San Diego, Naval Base Point Loma, and at NAB Coronado. Or overall, approximately 130,000 cubic yards of contaminated sediment have been removed. And I'm going to focus a little bit on Choyas Creek because there was an investigative order issued by your board up there. And one of the things that the Navy did is in 2017, we did do a dredging up in the upper portion of that on the Naval Base San Diego property that I'll show on another slide. Next slide, please. This picture just shows some of the what I'll call junk that we get when we do our dredging. It's all kinds of stuff, as you can see, all kinds of metal, all kinds of rubber, a variety of things that are in the sediment in San Diego Bay. And so every time we do a dredging project, we have to manage this material and get and dispose of it properly. Next slide, please. So this just shows the Choyas Creek area. The Choyas Creek dredging in 2017 that was referenced on a previous slide is shown in kind of the reddish highlight there. There are also some sampling locations that are shown where we did some confirmation sampling after the dredging. And then in the next slide, I'll talk about some upcoming dredging operations that we're going to do. And in particular, I just wanted to highlight that there's going to be a dredging of the Choyas Creek mouth is planned to start this summer. And that just kind of continues the dredging that was conducted in 2017. Next slide, please. So the planned dredging operations, again, you can see primary focus is in Naval Base San Diego, Naval Base Point Loma. I'm not going to go over all the details, but you can see that there's a lot going on all at once, a lot starting this spring and summer and late in the fall. Next slide, please. I did want to just briefly touch on the fact that as a support to the MOU that Kristen discussed, we've partnered with some other Navy entities in the San Diego Bay Area to do some sampling while we've been out doing some of these maintenance dredging. They've used advanced sensors and things to kind of look at dissolved oxygen pH and turbidity levels as those have been and look at it in the way of comparing in areas with larger grain sizes versus those with smaller grain sizes, measuring tides, et cetera. And one of the things that some of the conclusions, the other thing I wanted to mention is just that monitoring has been at kind of 200 and 500 foot arcs during the dredging. And so some of the conclusions that have come out of that are, we haven't had any issues achieving the basin plan limits for dissolved oxygen and pH. Background turbidity levels of the bay are very low, less than 5 NTUs, which, as a groundwater scientist, I can tell you that's clear water. When you're at 5 NTU, you can hardly tell that there's any dissolved material in there. And then the other thing that we found is the turbidity levels were really dependent on tide, sediment grain size, and the BMPs that were in place, which, probably follows logic. But it was lower. The turbidities were much lower at Naval Base Point Loma than Naval Base San Diego. And that's primarily because the grain size of the sediments at Point Loma tend to be larger than they are at Naval Base San Diego. We also see an increase in turbidity on outgoing tides. And we also concluded that silt curtains are an effective BMP at reducing turbidity where, outside the silt curtain, we had below at 5 NTU where, inside those silt curtains, they tended to be upwards of 50 NTU. Next slide, please. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Jason to talk about the next few slides. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Daryl. I'd like to start with a little disclaimer that I always have to say before when I start talking about the Bonhomme Richard, or as I'll say, the BHR for tongue-tying purposes throughout my brief, that there are many investigations still going on that are chaired by the commander of U.S. Pacific Fleet So there's only so much I am cleared to talk about before that report is made final in some manner or shape or form to the public. So just so everyone is aware of that, if there are questions, I may not be able to answer them at this time. But a little bit of background, the BHR is one of the Navy's landing helicopter deck amphibious assault ships. She came back from Asia around May of 2018 and went into a long-term maintenance availability, basically a long overhaul that started in November 2018. And even through this past summer, she came out of dry dock and moved to the Pier 2, where she continued maintenance while on the water. Approximately 8:30 in the morning on the 12th of July, a lovely Sunday morning, a fire broke out in the lower vehicle storage area while moored at Pier 2. One of the biggest risks we saw immediately was the potential of about 1 million gallons that was stored in the vessel to be spilled in some way, shape, or form as a result of this fire. The fuel tanks were about 3 to 4 levels below the initial source of the fire. I'm very happy to say that we were quite fortunate. The fire never reached that low, and all the double-walled tanks were still sealed and in good condition even after the fire. One of the first things we did that morning was we started initial outreach to our partners, U.S. Coast Guard, CalOSPR, and the Port of San Diego being the first. And then as we came into Monday, we also reached out to Mr. Gibson and Mr. McLean at the Water Board, the Air Pollution Control District, Cal EPA, U.S. EPA, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, as San Diego County Board of Supervisors, as well as many of the other local elected officials. We, with that smaller team of Coast Guard, OSPR, and Port of San Diego, we created an Environmental Emergency Operating Center as part of our larger Navy Environmental Operating Center, or EOC, and briefed daily and then shortened bi-daily almost twice a day in the beginning, and then kind of spread it out to once a day at the as with EPA and others as the week wore on. We supported the firefighting efforts from various federal fire teams. We had tugboats on the water that were also supporting the fire. Additionally, we used some helo squadrons from Naval Base Coronado to do airdrops, all using the San Diego Bay water to fight that fire. As the fire continued, we utilized our San Diego Bay contingency plan to deploy various resources throughout the area, including a triple boom around the BHR herself. Other resource areas, we deployed boom to protect. We had other equipment on site to ensure if we needed additional skimmers or other equipment, it was there, available, and ready to go. And then further sites further in the bay that may have been impacted that were additional resources, we also had booms prepped and ready to be installed in the case of an emergency or a release. We did not need to use any of that, so it was we see this as a huge win for the Navy. After the 4 days of the firefighting, the fires were extinguished aboard of the BHR. One of the big challenges we had during that fire was that the vessel started listing first to port up to 7 degrees, and there was a great concern there that we needed to start getting water off the vessel. We brought in 1 million gallon barge to collect water and thus reverse and then slow the listing while we continued to add water to the ship to put her out. We later moved that water from the barge into banker tanks for sampling, treatment, and disposal upland. The majority of the fire did use, as I said, San Diego Bay water. And in the final 24 hours of firefighting effort, we strategically used diluted AFFF to do more targeted attack, AFFF, aqueous foam forming fluid, to make sure that we could get to those sections of the ship where the source of the fire was in the hottest areas and get to that source and put her out completely. for sampling events, we did sampling on the piers for air quality, for environmental health and safety for our firefighters that were on deck and going in and out of the vessel. About half hour shifts were done by the firefighters. If anyone remembers that week, it was unbearably hot. We had some beautiful Santa Anas coming in, which increased the heat and the time that we could keep those firefighters on the vessel. So we wanted to make sure the air they're breathing it right at the pier too, were safe enough for them to be there. On top of that, we had COVID environment going on. So we also had anyone that was on the pier, not in part of the fire, also wearing face masks as well, just for safety and health and safety reasons as well. The San Diego Air Pollution Control District as their part, had air sampling locations throughout the county that they used to check the air quality throughout the county as from that. On Monday, when we called and talked with Sean and Mr. Gibson, we later coordinated with Sean to develop a sampling plan to check the water quality as this fire moved on. By day four of the fire, we were able to deploy and start a sampling effort. We had sampling events 1 day, 4 days, and 30 days after the fire. On the next slide, I do have some of the sampling results that I will share. We are finalizing our last report that has the 30-day on it. I've seen some of the numbers, but I haven't seen it in table form yet. So I unfortunately don't have those, but we will share that just as we did our draft with the water board staff. The water sampling results indicated that the fire response has not contributed to long-term water pollution of the San Diego Bay. I think that is one of the best things coming out of this with all of the efforts that we have done. We're happy to see the low output of that. At this time, the Navy does not plan to complete any additional sampling due to the levels that we had been noting within our sampling events. Moreover, it really is uncertain how much impact we would note from sediment sampling after the BHR is taken out due to the adjacent Choyas Creek outfall into the bay, as well as the locations just south of other industrial sites that may be possible to contribute to that. Actually, today, the BHR is going to be decommissioned and prepped for towing to Texas in the very near future.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yes, ma'am.
What are the words across the top? I'm sorry, I can't read them. And so,
on the table itself?
Sampling, whatever. But then they're, what the categories?
So the categories were VOCs, semi-VOCs, PAH, furans, dioxins, and PFAS.
Okay.
And also on that slide, should there be one more date of sampling or data from one more day of samples?
Yes, there is data. As I said a few minutes ago, we do have the third sampling date. We don't have that in table form yet. So we're waiting for the final report to come out, which will be shared. The little bit of data I did see is pretty much everything went to non-detect, where I think on the 30th, most things are at non-detect. There's just a few points within PFAS that were at 10, 5.3, 5.3, 4.8, which is still rather low when you look at it from the EPA size. The EPA number is, I believe around 70 PPT of concern. So we're below that. But I don't have that data as table format, so I wasn't able to share it at this time.
Is that EPA limit for PFAS one that is expected to be found in water in a marine environment?
Daryl, I think you're better at answering that question than me. Are you there, Daryl? He may have had to drop off.
Sorry, I apologize. I was muted and I was trying to figure out how to get back on here. I'm not used to using Zoom, believe it or not. We're so used to Teams. So the EPA number, which is 70 parts per trillion for PFOA or PFAS, that is for a tap water drinking water number. At this juncture, I don't believe there have been any values established for what's protective in a saltwater environment. I know that there's a number of research aspects that are going on looking at, you know, ecological risk and risk to ecological receptors, but there's not really anything fully established yet. So the numbers that Jason mentioned with EPA are really focused on human health and drinking water exposure from the tap. I will say that this, you know, the state of California through the state board has also established some drinking water reporting levels that are down around the 5 to 6 parts per trillion level. But again, those are focused almost primarily on drinking water and not salt water. Over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you.
All right. I just have one question. Yep. Do you have to meet the federal standards or the state standards? This is Betty Olson. I'm sorry.
For standards for drinking water, stormwater,
for the marine environment, sort of what we're talking about. I just wondered. I know the regional board asked you to do things, but I just wondered, since you're a federal agency in state and federal waters,
We are still subject to in water. We are still subject to the requirements of the state and the local as well, due to the Federal Facilities Compliance Act.
Thanks.
No problem. Hearing no other questions, I will continue on to the next slide. If everyone agrees.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Really quick, we're talking about some of the water quality improvements that the Navy has been part of in the Bay. The first one is pier piling replacement program. So over the past 15 to 20 years, whenever we have a project where we are upgrading or replacing or repairing piers on the water, we ensure that we are removing the creosote wood piles that were historically put in and replacing those with inert materials such as concrete or high density plastic piles. Historic studies done by the Navy have marked the reduction of polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons within the bay water samples after those piles have been removed. So we see this as a really a big win throughout that. We remove these piles as we are able to and to the greatest extent possible as we're looking at the stability of the surrounding ocean environment and ensuring appropriate work and maneuverability for all our Navy vessels there. Additionally, we had steam decentralization happen around the bay. In the past, the large project had that we executed over the 4 years, we had old steam systems on all the installations that supported both heating and industrial systems and activities throughout the installations. What we did over the 4 years was replace those large plants, the cogen plants that we had on those sites with smaller, what they call boiler in a box systems. So much smaller boilers at specific sites. The benefits of the bay there was that we removed that discharge into the bay that had the condensate from the cogen plant, which resulted in some zinc and some copper loading into the San Diego Bay. So it's just another project that where we upgraded our systems and we're able to find that reduction. Flip to the next slide. We'll also talk about one of the biggest efforts that we have, and we coordinate with the city of San Diego on this, and that is trash removal from the bay, Choyas and Paleta Creek. So much of this effort is we are the fortunate, I say that sarcastically, downstream recipients of a lot of trash within the stream beds, especially during large storm events. And I'll have a picture on the next slide, but just staying here for a minute. We moved over 250 tons of material in the past 10 years throughout these areas. We are constantly meeting with the city and looking for a long-term solution to this cleanup in the Bay. These cleanups, we use Navy personnel, both uniform and civilian. We reach out to the city and in some areas reach out to environmental groups or other groups to see how they can support this event. This is helpful for us from not just the sustainability of the Bay and cleanup of the Bay, but there are definitely there's operational impacts as to some of this trash can damage ships. Many times we put divers into our waters so that we can look at the ships underneath, and we want to make sure their health, their safety, and there's nothing in the water that could impact them. And then finally, due to our natural resource conservation management, we need to make sure that our beaches are clean and safe for the habitat for the species, as well as those other kind of Navy SEALs that do a lot of training on the Delta beaches within the San Diego Bay that really shouldn't be running into much of the trash on those Delta beaches. Below, you'll see just a quick slide of some of the measurements of the amount of trash we have picked up. That's just at Naval Base San Diego. By the Naval Base San Diego Public Works team, as well as the Port Ops team down there. And then finally for me, one more slide. This is a picture after one rain event to see just a little bit of a sample of some of the trash that has been found in the bay after that cleanup that's held by one of our booms at the base of the Chilias Creek. At this time, I'd like to hand off to Walt Wilson to talk to us about some of the natural resource enhancements and the natural resource program we have in San Diego Bay. Next slide, please.
Okay, can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
We can.
Roger. Okay, so one of the things that we have for the Bay, and this is kind of got started back in around 2001, 2002, in the face of Endangered Species Act and the Central Fish Habitat, Magnuson-Stevens restrictions on some of our installations to protect species. The Sykes Act was born, and that required that Department of Defense installations have an integrated natural resource management plan to make sure that we were doing things in a manner that did not affect or detrimentally affect species and their habitats. One of the unique things about the San Diego Bay Integrated Natural Resource Management Plan is we decided, since we are a major stakeholder and property owner on the bay and we have a port partner, that we should be kind of doing things the same. So we were able to get permission from Washington, D.C. to have the Port of San Diego join us in our San Diego Bay in-rump. There's a few other things that are different about it. It's the only in-rump that covers a body of water. We did this because we have seven or eight, you know, installations around the bay, and it would have been really difficult to manage their effects on the water. And then, of course, now we brought in the port. Early on, this port partnership won a presidential award for innovation on how to manage habitats. So what the Integrated Natural Resource Management Plan does is it kind of guides us in how we conduct projects in our developments around the bay to make sure that we are not having detrimental effects to the maximum extent possible. We avoid minimizing to the maximum extent possible. But the interrupt goes one step further. It tells us that when you can make the habitat better, even if it's not right in the zone of the project. Some of these things take a long time, especially on a big place, you know, like the bay and some of our largest installations. So we do those things. And to do that, we need to know what's living in the bay, what's the status of the, you know, the habitats around the bay. You know, we've got them all identified, and we do a lot of monitoring efforts. So we partner with other agencies. For instance, we do a lot of green sea turtle work with the National Marine Fisheries Service, our partnership with the port and the Southwest Fisheries Science Center. So when Southwest Fisheries Science Center is out doing work looking for turtles, our personnel are out there with them. And we also provide financial resources. We've bought a lot of tags to make sure that we are an active participant in that. We do marine mammal surveys for just about every single project that we do. In partnership with the port, we provide resources, and we do this every other year. So we do the financial resources with the port. We kind of alternate years. We do fisheries inventories. And of course, we both agencies do water bird surveys every year. And all that data is collected, and it's all publicly available. And all of that is focused on making sure we are meeting the requirements, our federal requirements under the Sykes Act, to support the interim. We also have some marine invasive species assessments going on. Now, we do one as within the Navy, but it's very similar to one that we facilitate. So the California Department of Fish and Wildlife contracts through the Smithsonian Environmental Research Center to do invasive species studies. And it has a lot to do with, you know, ballast water that's coming in from all over the world. And they're actually, the Smithsonian's coming out here in May this year to do their invasive species. And they do San Diego Bay about every 3 years. We do our local study every year. And then we've recently gotten involved in trying to do an ecological functional value study. Now, we over the years have defined and delineated all the different habitats in the interim, and we are trying to get, you know, now take one step further and go, what's the functional value of all these, and are they working the way they should? Next slide, please.
Before you leave that, Mr. Wilson, yep. If I could ask, yep. What kind of invasive species are you finding?
So we haven't really found anything that's real, you know, big and bad, like, you know, some of the mussel species. There are some invasive species, but they're really not hurting the bay very much. We haven't found any real detrimental ones like they've got up in Sacramento, you know, the green crabs. But there mm-hmm. are a lot of small microscopic organisms that we have found, and I can't off the top of my head come up with all these scientific names, but we haven't found anything really bad here yet. Most of the stuff is all microscopic and filter feeders.
Thank you.
Yep. So some of the other, I talked about the interim saying you got to go out and make the habitat better. So to do that, you know, we're always looking for how can we leverage some of our projects to improve habitat around the bay, even if it's not right where we're building something. And some of those projects are the Le Méridien Reef, which is just to the east of Coronado and north of the Coronado Bay Bridge around that anchorage there. That was a result of taking material from Pier 12 at Navy Base San Diego back in 2012, I think we built it, and we built a reef there. You'll see a picture there. Homeport Island, which is a mitigation project that we did as a result of the carrier wharf being expanded, that produced small island, but more than anything, there's a lot of big mud flats there now along the west side of the bay, south of NAB, that provide tremendous habitat for birds. And then just recently, we have been able to leverage a bunch of projects to build and restore Smuggler's Cove, which is just inside the bay at Ballast Point. There was a big beach there that was on, you know, was used for recreational for the sailors' families, but it gotten washed away through some you know, El Nino and severe winters we had. We leveraged, I think, at least four projects to make that happen over the course of about 5 years, just bringing all that together. And what really got it started was the boat channel. We were able to get some mitigation money for our eelgrass bank to get the regulatory hoops out of the way. And once we got through the regulatory hoops, it was difficult for the Navy and our financial system back in DC to deny us, because we already had approval from the regulatory agencies to go, this is a go. So that gave us the ability to leverage some other projects. We one of the things that happens out of Ballast Point every couple of years is dredging of the Coast Guard station, because it fills in with sand as the sand heads out to the ocean. So they've got to dredge that. We took all that sand and we put it up on high on the beach while we used all the leftover material from the Point Loma fuel pier, which we demolished and had up on land. But rather than take it to a landfill, and there was a lot of material, we saved it. It was all these giant square blocks, and we puzzle pieced it together and built an 18-foot high reef just offshore Ballast Point. And then we took all that sand from the Coast Guard dredging project and pushed it in there to about 6 feet underwater low tide. And we turned that into a new site, about 3/4 of an acre of eelgrass habitat. And it's really, it's kind of a landmark project. It's really only been completed about a year now. The eelgrass is going crazy. The reef is loaded with lobsters. We've got studies going on to make sure that, you know, there aren't any invasive species. It's very similar invasive species stuff, but we're looking at, you know, how is a reef habitated? I'm not sure of the word, but, you know, how do these things become inhabited, you know, as they grow over the years? And National Marine Fisheries Services is right on board with us on this. So that's really a landmark project, I think, is going to tell us a lot about what goes on in the bay and how healthy the bay is. What else we got? So we partner with Wildlife Assist and Rehabilitation, just like all the cities and jurisdictions around the bay do, to make sure that, you know, any animals that are found, we can get them healthy again. One of the big things that came out of the fuel pier project, which was a 5 or 6 year project, that is only work in the water. It probably took 10 years to get it done. But there was a lot of marine mammal studies that had happened then. And we're like, we can't be doing these marine mammal studies all the time. We need to know more about the sound in the bay. So we put together, and it's still just about finished now because we're getting the south end of the bay done. But we now have a compendium of sound in the bay for different kinds of pile driving and the activities we do. San Diego Bay ambient sound, it's very loud. So in many cases, the projects that we do, pile driving, they really aren't louder than acoustics. But we now have the data to tell us that. So we don't have to go and fund new studies every time and do a project. Of course, you know, here in San Diego, we have probably the largest least tern and snowy plover, you know, communities in Southern California. And we do a lot of work for that. One of the things we also do every February, when the least terns are getting ready to arrive, we go out and pick up the trash that, you know, that gets away from us. It's Choyas Creek or comes in from Otay. And then anytime we can divert sediment to offshore disposal to, you know, replenish beaches, we do that. Next slide, please. So I talked about Lee Meridian Reef, which was Pier 12. And these pictures are a depiction of that. And they kind of go in reverse order. But first time I saw this, and these were just taken very recently, this last one, the very bright red one, I was like, oh my God, that's in San Diego Bay. So from top left, that was just taken this year. And then the next one on the right was previous year. We had to do four years of studying or monitoring of this. And it goes all the way back to the one on the bottom right is when it started. Lynn Meridian Reef was the site that was picked out, and it was identified by California Department of Fish and Wildlife and National Marine Fisheries Services. If we built a reef in the bay, not we, but if anybody built a reef in the bay, that would be a good spot. We came up with the material to do it, and they let us do that there. So, yeah, I saw that picture up on the upper left, and I was like, wow, that's San Diego Bay. Okay, next shot. Next slide. So one of the other things we do in San Diego Bay is we have an eelgrass mitigation bank. It's the first eelgrass mitigation bank in the state of California. It became the model for all other banking instruments that are being developed, of which there are still very few. The Port of San Diego is really just now getting their mitigation bank online down in the salt pond. Of course, it's not an eelgrass mitigation bank, but it is a mitigation bank, mostly mudflats. Our bank kind of became not only the model for banks, but it became the model for how NIMS and Army Corps of Engineers developed the Southern California Eelgrass Mitigation Plan, which became, again, the California Eelgrass Mitigation Plan. Our bank started about 15 or maybe 16 or 17 years ago now at about 8 acres, all on Navy submerged lands. It has now grown to about 14 acres. One of the things about all our eelgrass efforts is, and this is another thing we're doing in partnership with the port, because the port has eelgrass, habitat too, is we share resources and we both fund a cooperative port and Navy Bay-wide eelgrass monitoring effort. We go out every single year, and we have a contractor who's been on this forever. He's probably the eelgrass god of California. He works all over the West Coast. The last 2 years, we're seeing records amount of eelgrass all over the place. And that is a result of all of our efforts, not just the navies and the ports, but the water boards and everybody that has anything to do with water quality in San Diego Bay, improving the habitat in San Diego Bay and the water quality. So we're seeing deeper photic zones, which is facilitating growth of eelgrass into deeper areas. So our eelgrass and our banks are, we're getting bigger, which is good for us because we can use the bank when we need to develop something and we can't avoid and minimize impacts to eelgrass. And the other thing I wanted to say about the eelgrass mitigation bank, I manage the eelgrass bank. Jason is, and it belongs to the Admiral, but Jason and I manage that together. And we don't just give those credits out willy-nilly. And a lot of the biologists in the Navy, like, oh, well, we'll just use the eelgrass mitigation bank for that impact. Well, it's not that easy. We make sure that they have done everything possible to avoid and minimize impacts. Let me give you an example of that. About 5 years ago, one of the managers wanted to come and they wanted to do a dredging on the south side or the north side of NAB. And they wanted 8 acres of eelgrass. We're like, well, that'll wipe out the eelgrass bank. So we went back and we got that down to about 1.25 acres, which was, quite impressive. And I think after all the surveys were done, it came out even less than that. But another example is, sometimes they want to use 0.5 acre. And there was a recent project, which I've just written a letter of approval for. They wanted 0.5 acre, and we got that down to 41 square feet. So the biologists, our own biologists, struggle, but we make them struggle to make sure that they avoid and minimize everything. Okay, next slide, please. And this is, I think, my last slide. This photo on the left is it's actually a poster that we have made up every year of all the eelgrass in the bay. And then the one on the right shows our six eelgrass banking sites. So the last thing I want to say is I want you all to be assured that you have, you know, in the Navy, we've got a bunch of really great, you know, environmental scientists and planners and biologists who are overzealous to make sure that they are protecting the bay and doing everything possible to make the bay better. And, you know, you have a partner in that. And I know the National Marine Fisheries Service looks at us as a partner in taking care of the bay. So thanks for letting me present today.
Thank you. And we're very happy we have a partner. We think this is very, very important work. And it looks like progress is being made, at least in many dimensions. So at this point, we'll open it up for questions from our board members. Please raise your real hand or virtual hand. Do we have any questions from our public? Ah, I see Dr. Olson. Go ahead.
Okay, so I had a couple of questions. One, I just wanted to clarify something for me. So the length of time it requires to complete one of these dredging projects, and if I understood it correctly, there's a 4 to 5 year planning time and then about 4 years to actualize the project. And is there anything that we could help you do, or we could look into helping, that could make that time less? I mean, or is that just how long it takes to get the money? And so I don't know who I should direct this to, but I direct whomever I should.
Well, since I presented the dredging, it's probably something I could answer. But we do have one other person that is our dredging expert that I asked to be on the phone today to help answer questions with respect to dredging. She might be a little bit more, but I think you're on track. Just as a general statement, there's a fair lead time and planning that has to go into it. This money has to be congressionally allocated, that kind of thing. So it does take time. There's a lot of different entities involved in getting these projects going and getting them started and done. But I'd like to see if Lindsay Name, who's also on the call, would like to add any other details.
Sure. Hi, this is Lindsay Name. I'm with the Navy. So I think Daryl captured it. A lot of, you know, depending on the project, if it's a deepening project, it might be, you know, a military construction that goes through appropriations, or, you know, we have different funding sources if it's maintenance dredging. And sometimes I think one of the biggest challenges are we can't really control the money, you know, when it comes. And so sometimes we're forced to issue contracts, you know, maybe prior to doing the sediment sampling or knowing, you know, getting the permitting in place. And so we have to make assumptions. And that's, you know, where our work with the Water Board on this MOA that Kristen presented will be really helpful in kind of streamlining those requirements. So, you know, even if we award the contract before, you know, we have all the information, we at least can anticipate what the requirements will be. So sometimes, you know, we know the projects well ahead of time, where others were just kind of on standby until we get the funding. And the, you know, the projects can take, you know, anywhere from a couple weeks of dredging to several months of dredging, just depending on, you know, the cubic yards and whether it's, you know, needs to dry. You know, if it's going to a landfill, it can take a lot longer as opposed to if it's ocean disposal. So the length of dredging actually depends.
Seems like the entire process is a multi-year process. And so if I were looking ahead to just ask a general question in this, so if, how long will it take the areas you showed in red and yellow, which I'm not sure what it means, but to all be transformed, I'll say, to green?
Are you talking about the contaminated sediment at Naval Base San Diego that showed? Uh-huh. So, I mean, I think we have a couple of unknowns when it comes to the contamination. You know, obviously we do the sediment characterization before dredging. We have information, but we don't know the depth that that contamination occurs, and that contamination has been removed. So it's not showing what's left. You know, we have some historical information on where we removed. But in other cases, like we might know we dredged in the 50s, but we don't know, do we dredge the whole footprint or just in, you know, an area here and there. We have, you know, maybe some areas we haven't dredged along the quay wall just for safety reasons. We don't dredge right up to the quay wall. And so that's the purpose of this sediment investigation we're doing, are to try to fill those gaps, determine the impact that dredging has had on removing sediment and where those hot spots still exist, at what depth, you know, and where throughout Naval Base San Diego. So we don't know that information yet. You know, we're going to look at the sources, you know, the contribution. Is it coming from Choyas and Paleta Creek, from watershed sources? Is it coming from historical Navy IR sites that are along, you know, like shoreside sites that could be impacting the bay? And then what has been removed and kind of what remains. So those are things that we will be investigating as part of the preliminary assessment and site inspection. And so we don't have all those answers yet.
Okay, and if you'll bear with me, I just have one last question. And you referred to Mr. Van Winkle, or Dr. Van Winkle, I'm not quite sure what your title, referred to Silver Strand. And it was a red area, and it said it's not being looked at because it's in the South Bay. I just didn't understand the rationale for that.
Sorry, that was me that mentioned the Silver Strand Training Center.
Oh, I'm sorry, I apologize.
Yeah, and what I meant by that was that it's not anticipated to have maintenance dredging down there.
So you don't need maintenance dredging. Does the
right. Navy need to be dredged? Right. The Navy can correct me if I'm wrong, but it's so far south that they don't have ships down there.
So I understand, but does it need to be dredged? Did the red mean that there was...
Oh, you mean for contamination?
Yes.
Oh, we haven't looked at that yet in detail.
Okay.
That'll be probably part of a future study.
Does that mean that you don't know if it's contaminated or it's on the study list because I apologize. I don't know the criteria for this or understand them totally for the...
Well, if you go back to the map that I was showing, there wasn't a lot of red down in that area. I think most of that area was green.
I thought there was one, but I definitely, I'll look at the slides when they're posted.
Great.
Thank you so much. That's all.
Any other questions from the board members? I have a quick question, I think, for Mr. Van Winkle, but whomever is the best to answer it, maybe Ms. Neem. Of all of your spoils or the dredge material, could you just do a general assessment? What percentage goes to landfill? What percentage goes to unconfined aquatic disposition? How is it disposed of generally? What's the breakdown?
You want me to take that, Lindsay?
I can answer it because I just calculated it for another source. I think it's about 74%. Ocean disposal, because primarily, or I'm kind of lumping beneficial reuse and ocean disposal together, you know, in about 26% upland. But, you know, Naval Base San Diego tends to be more heavily, you know, upland, whereas Point Loma has been, you know, all suitable for unconfined aquatic disposal. But in fact, the latest Naval Base San Diego project, out of 60,000 cubic yards that were characterized, only 500 were contaminated. So, you know, I think it's demonstrating that things are getting better, you know, the more we dredge. But right now, you know, it's, I think when I looked at all the recent dredging projects where I had data on, it was, you know, around 74-75% ocean disposal.
Thank you. I think at this point, we'll take questions from the public, and after that concludes, we'll take a 5-minute break before we start on our next item.
Could I just...
Are there any questions from the public? Oh, I'm sorry, Dr. Wilson.
I wanted to say, really compliment on the work that's been done. I didn't say that. I asked my questions, but so you're doing a great job. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Board Chair Cantu, I'd like to offer that if any member of the public would like to speak, to remind them to go ahead and virtually raise their hand in Zoom or press *9 on your phone now. And if you do, please remember to state your name for the record before you speak. And at this time, I'm not seeing any hands being raised.
Well, let's thank the presentation from our staff and from the Navy. We appreciate that. It was very enlightening. I want to praise progress. It's a huge undertaking, and it's one that will continue forever and ever. But we're really happy to see the progress and your presentation to take the time to share with us. We really do appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take a 5-minute break now. I have 11:11. So we'll reconvene at 11:16. Thank you very much. I think we're getting everybody back on screen here. Our next item is an informational item on PFAS, detection to protection, methods for finding and removing forever chemicals in groundwater, wastewater, and drinking water. Mr. Boyd, are you ready to present?
I am ready. Thank you, Board Chair Cantu. Good morning, Vice Chair Olson and members of the board. My name is Daniel Boyd, and I'm an engineering geologist here in Region 9's Site Restoration Unit. I'd like to introduce and set the stage for Agenda Item 4. During the PFAS informational item last June, members of the board and the public learned about the broader per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAS group of chemicals, and two of the perfluoroalkyl acids, PFOA and PFOS. We heard from representatives of the State Water Board's Division of Drinking Water, Division of Water Quality, and our own Region 9 about the broader scope of PFAS and the statewide orders. By that point, the State Water Board had issued investigative orders to chrome plating facilities, airports, and landfills, as well as sampling orders to neighboring public water supplies. Since June of 2020, the State Water Board has issued additional orders to publicly owned treatment works. And as State Board Member Firestone mentioned, most recently, on March 21st of this year, the State Water Board issued investigative orders to refineries and bulk fuel terminal facilities. Following the June informational item, several more specific inquiries about PFAS were made by the board. Those inquiries included analytical testing methods for PFAS in drinking water samples versus those for non-drinking water samples, the approaches to removing or mitigating PFAS chemicals found in the drinking water supply, such as the Orange County Water District's PFAS pilot program, and the current understanding of the human health effects and public health goals. For this informational item, we have two presentations, one from the State Water Board's Environmental Laboratory Accreditation Program, or ELAP, and the second from the Orange County Water District. Before I introduce the speakers, I'd like to let the board know that we also have several state agency representatives in attendance today to answer questions you, the Navy, or the public may have following the presentations. From the Division of Water Quality, I'd like to welcome back Senior Engineering Geologist and Specialist, Ms. Wendy Link, and Senior Engineering Geologist, Ms. Brianna St. Pierre. The Division of Water Quality and regional boards are leading the non-drinking water investigations and issuing water quality investigative orders per water code authorities. From the Division of Drinking Water, we have Mr. Jeff O'Keefe in attendance. Mr. O'Keefe is a supervising sanitary engineer and has also previously presented for this board. The Division of Drinking Water is leading investigations to assess impacts to drinking water supplies. The DDW issues notification levels, response levels, and establishes regulatory maximum contaminant levels, or MCLs, based on the public health goal recommendations from the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment, or OEHA. The DDW implements tools under the Health and Safety Code. From OEHA, we have staff toxicologist Dr. Chris Banks in attendance today. OEHA is the agency charged with developing health protective exposure levels for contaminants in air, water, and soil as guidance for regulatory agencies and the public. This includes the rigorous process for establishing public health goals, or PHGs, for contaminants in drinking water. And Dr. Banks has been developing PHGs in the water toxicology section since 2011. For our first presentation, we have Ms. Christine Sotelo from ELAP. Ms. Sotelo is the Environmental Program Manager and Chief for ELAP. Also joining us from ELAP is Mr. Jacob Oaxaca, a Senior Environmental Scientist with the ELAP program. Under the Division of Drinking Water, ELAP services all state agencies and is responsible for laboratory accreditation for specific test methods. Their presentation will provide background information and the framework for how analytical test methods are identified and approved for regulatory purposes, and also how that relates to the PFAS investigative orders. Our second speaker, Dr. Megan Plumley, is the Research Director for the Orange County Water District and Program Manager for the district's PFAS pilot study. The OCWD is the public agency that manages a portion of the Santa Ana River and the Orange County Groundwater Basin. The OCWD provides groundwater to 19 municipal and special water districts that serve approximately 2.5 million residents in northern and central Orange County. PFAS has been detected in the Orange County groundwater basin, and due to exceedances of PFAS response levels in certain locations, several groundwater protection wells have been taken offline. The OCWD has completed a PFAS treatment study, and they have begun the design and construction of PFAS treatment systems that Dr. Plumley will discuss in her presentation. Now I'll bring up the slides for Christine and Jacob's presentation.
All right. Can you hear me?
Yes.
All right. So good afternoon, everyone. As Daniel mentioned, I'm Christine Sotelo, and I'm the Program Manager for California ELAP. I'm very excited to be here today to present to you about our program here within the Water Board. I just want to say hello to the Chair, Celeste Cantu, and also Vice Chair Olson and the fellow board members, and thank you again for inviting us to talk to you. So, next slide. So, who are we? So, as Daniel gave a brief summary of what we do, we're a program within the Division of Drinking Water at the Water Board. We were created within the requirements of the legislature in 1988. So we're not a new program. We've been around for a while. We resided within the Department of Public Health since 2014 when we transferred over to the Water Board. And our mission is to ensure that your region and other state programs have available data to make important decisions, that the laboratory staff are competent, the laboratory equipment is sufficient, and to make to provide data used for your decision making. And we do this by the experts within our program. We have a multidisciplinary team of chemists, scientists, and microbiologists. And we also provide technical expertise on regulatory and laboratory science. We also are much like other programs that you use to regulate the facilities within your region, we regulate laboratories and we investigate for fraud, inappropriate lab practices, and ensure that we level the playing field for the laboratories that are providing data to all of your data needs. We have about 600 laboratories that we accredit within California, outside California, and even in other countries. As you can see here in this slide, we support many agencies, so not just the Water Board's programs. And we take it very seriously. Next slide. Our responsibility is something that we share with regulatory agencies and ELAP. The regulatory agencies, like yourself at the region, you consider the different methods that are available to you to use. You weigh the advantages and the disadvantages of each of those methods, and then you request accreditation for those methods from ELAP. Ultimately, you determine the best approach based on your regulatory objectives, your fit for purpose. And ELAP shares this responsibility by consulting with you. We participate in many interagency groups, specifically with PFAS, and we're always advocating for the best data quality for your programs. And then we accredit the laboratories for your regulatory purpose. Our mission is to ensure that the standards for scientific integrity and laboratory operations are met. And now I'd like to hand it over to Jacob. But to end it, I'd like to say that laboratory data is the backbone of scientific decision making, and we take it very seriously, and we're here to support you.
Thank you. We agree. And thank you for that presentation.
You're welcome.
Hi, good morning. This is Jacob Oaxaca. As Mr. Boyd said during the introduction, I'm a senior technical advisor. Well, first of all, can you hear me, right?
Yes.
Okay, great. So as I mentioned, my name is Jacob Oaxaca. I'm a senior technical advisor and I work very closely with Christine. And I'm also the liaison between ELAP and our regulatory agency partners who rely on the data generated by our ELAP accredited laboratories. That is to say, the agencies that are using the data as the cornerstone for their decision-making. I routinely support your staff here at the San Diego Regional Board, as well as the other 8 regional boards, the Water Board's Division of Drinking Water, and the Division of Water Quality. It is a pleasure to be here with you and on this panel today, and to provide as an informational item, a discourse on the landscape of PFAS analytical methods. Next slide. One more slide, please. So this is a similar opening slide as the one used last year during the update that was provided to you on the Water Board's PFAS actions. And really, it's just a high-level reintroduction to PFAS. Per and perfluoroalkyl substances are a very large family of thousands of chemicals that vary widely in their chemical and physical properties. We know that it was used since the 1940s, specifically for its range of industrial and commercial applications. And in general, PFAS chemicals have a hydrophilic or a water-loving head and a hydrophobic or a water-hating tail. And from a testing standpoint, it requires sophisticated analytical instrumentation to detect. And these instruments don't run themselves, so there's also a need for experienced scientists who are capable of synthesizing and interpreting the data. Next slide. And naturally, as our frontline scientists improve at measuring PFAS, the concentrations we can regulate marches downwards. As an example, in the 1980s, the first proposed limit for PFOA was 600 parts per trillion. This limit was based solely on our analytical capabilities at that time. Well, fast forward 40 years, and we are now capable of analyzing certain PFAS compounds down to the single digit part per trillion range. Suffice it to say, we've made some significant strides, and a big reason why is the advancements in technology. Next slide. You know, one of the things I enjoy most about being a chemist is the analytical tools that are in our toolbox. And this slide here gives you a flavor of the various tools that have been used over time to analyze for trace levels of compounds, such as PFAS. I'll start on the left with gas chromatography, which I would say is the one instrument that most non-scientists are familiar with or know about. It's a common instrument in almost every laboratory, and for PFAS, it was one of the first tools used. But it had limitations, and this was due to the structure of PFAS, specifically the hydrophilic head side of the compounds, which made for poor chromatography. This, in turn, increased detection limits to undesirable levels. Another tool that's been used is ion chromatography. However, the detection limits with this instrumentation were too high to be useful for PFAS concentrations typically found in drinking water, so it did not become a common tool used moving forward. That now brings me to today's instrument of choice, liquid chromatography and tandem mass spectrometry, or LC-MS/MS. This is one of the most powerful instruments that environmental testing laboratories will invest in. They run a little over $500,000 per unit. It's a highly sophisticated instrument that allows us to fingerprint and quantify compounds simultaneously. When combined with a sample preparation technique called solid phase extraction, or SPE, the LC-MS/MS is unrivaled in its ability to reach the lowest detection levels for PFAS. This wraps up this slide on instruments and techniques used for PFAS, but as the title suggests, the technology is expected to continue to evolve as regulators, analysts, and equipment suppliers respond to the ever-growing understanding of PFAS chemistry. Next slide. So as one of the earlier slides said, our ability to protect is dependent on our ability to detect. And right now, even though the technology is impressive, the current analytical methods are only capable of detecting a limited number of compounds. And one of the reasons why is that there's a lack of reference standards to compare and match the raw data to. But the scientific community is forging on and gradually increasing the scope of compounds that we can detect, as well as finding innovative ways of achieving lower detection limits. Another area at the forefront with regards to the state of PFAS analysis is the development and validation of methods for non-drinking water matrices. And you'll hear more about this in the coming slides. Next slide. So I'm hoping that you picked up on a key term that I just mentioned, which was validation of methods. If you didn't, that's okay. Either way, I'm going to pause here and talk about why methods are validated. Method validation is the process for demonstrating that a method is fit for purpose. So what do I mean by fit for purpose? Well, what that means is that the method has been thoroughly reviewed and tested in such a way that the standards for quality, reliability, and comparability are achievable. And like so many other things, the way methods are validated vary depending on several factors. One being the measurement objectives. If the method is going to only be used for, say, screening purposes, like information gathering or scientific studies, the validation criteria that needs to be met may not be as equivalent as, say, for compliance testing. As an aside, it's important to note that the regulatory agencies, such as the regional boards, are not the ones who validate the methods. That responsibility generally lies with the organization that developed the method, whether it's a scientific organization or an individual laboratory. The last point I want to drive home regarding method validation is related to the different standards or levels of validation, and that one is not more superior than the other. What it comes down to is fit for purpose and risk. Next slide, please. In some instances, it may be acceptable for the method to have no validation at all. For example, a laboratory may modify a method to improve its functionality, but be unable to validate the modifications. If the modified method was then determined to be the best available method for meeting a certain measurement objective, then a regulatory agency can weigh that against the purpose for use of the method and then decide that the benefits of using a non-validated method outweigh the risk. They can also decide to then approve that method for use. The other two levels of validation build on each other and are somewhat self-explanatory. What single laboratory validation demonstrates is that the analytical procedures and quality control criteria that are outlined in the method can be successfully achieved in at least one laboratory. Again, it comes down to fit for purpose and risk. So the example here is, if the San Diego Regional Board had a permitted discharger with a state-specific contaminant that is unique to only one site, then the regional board may decide that it would be acceptable for that sample to be analyzed by a method that has been validated only at a single laboratory. The last level of validation, before I move on to talking about the specific methods for PFAS, is multi-laboratory validation. As the term implies, this means that the analytical procedures and quality control criteria of the method can be successfully achieved across multiple laboratories and that the results from each of the laboratories are comparable. So that's more than you probably ever wanted to know about method validation, but as you will see in the next set of slides, the landscape of methods for PFAS include methods that are validated at these varying levels. Next slide. So the way that I chose to present for the next set of slides on the methods for PFAS is to break it out into methods that analyze for individual compounds and methods that are used to measure the total amount, or otherwise known as per class methods. Next slide. The per compound methods can be considered as targeted analysis. In other words, the methods are designed to test for a specific list of compounds. The upside with this strategy is the degree of certainty. At the conclusion of the analysis, we will know with a known degree of certainty how much of each individual compound is present. The downside is that the current per compound methods are only capable of detecting a limited number of compounds. On the other hand, per class methods can be thought of as non-targeted analysis, such that the methods are capable of potentially capturing additional compounds that would otherwise not be detected when using the per compound methods. Unfortunately, the degree of certainty, or I should say uncertainty, is the downside with this strategy. To address this, samples analyzed using per class methods are typically followed up with analysis by the per compound methods, and that's done in order to confirm the presence or absence of the PFAS compounds that are of the most concern. Next slide. So dialing down into the methods, I'm going to start with the per compound choices that are specifically designed for drinking water. The US EPA came out with method 537 in 2009. This method was able to evaluate 14 different PFAS. In 2018, EPA updated this method and it's now called 537.1. It includes four additional PFAS, including the chemical known as Gen X. This method has been multi-laboratory validated. And now that you've got that background about what validation means, you now understand that this method is capable of being used by multiple laboratories across state and across the nation. In addition to method 537.1, the EPA has released a separate method for PFAS analysis in drinking water that improves on the accuracy of measuring the short chain PFAS. This method captures 11 of those short chain PFAS in addition to 14 of the 18 PFAS that are capable of being analyzed in the original 537.1. The last point I will make is that both of these methods utilize the highest level of technology, which is the solid phase extraction, followed by LC-MS-MS. Next slide. The methods for drinking water are pretty established at this point in time in terms of being able to reliably detect PFAS. But it is important to note that these methods are not suitable for non-drinking water samples. And the simple answer for why this is that the matrix for groundwater, wastewater, soil, or other matrices, are more complex, and they create challenges with interferences and elevated detection limits. So to meet the testing demand for regulatory purposes, such as the State Board PFAS investigative orders, laboratories have resorted to modifying the drinking water methods. These modifications have actually led to expanded compound lists and improved detection limits. So that was certainly a plus. However, the downside is that the modifications are unique to each laboratory, which can then impact the comparability of results when regulatory agencies are receiving data from different laboratories. To address these comparability issues and have higher confidence in the data, the Department of Defense has developed a comprehensive set of performance-based criteria. This performance-based criteria is the best alternative at this time and provides the most current and comprehensive set of quality standards for PFAS analysis in non-drinking water samples. Next slide. So this slide sums up what I just explained. The current per compound methods for non-drinking water or other matrices are limited to in-house modified methods that use solid phase extraction, LC-MS-MS, and most importantly, the Department of Defense performance-based criteria. The minimum number of compounds that we are currently expecting laboratories to be able to reliably detect falls around 30 or so. However, we've been hearing feedback from the community that a few laboratories have now increased their capabilities to almost up to 70 compounds. Next slide. I'm going to wrap up this section on the per compound methods with a few points about what's on the horizon. The first one is that the EPA will be releasing multi-laboratory validated methods for non-drinking water samples. The new methods will standardize the modifications and incorporate the DoD comprehensive set of quality standards. I don't have an exact date on when this is expected to happen, but I can say that once they are released, it's expected that these methods will replace the current approach of using modified methods in conjunction with the DoD criteria. And that's because the staff from the Department of Defense who developed that criteria, as well as other laboratory experts who have been coming up with these innovative modifications, they've been working closely with EPA to comment, peer review, and validate these new methods. The next big thing on the horizon is the advancement of predictive software tools. This software complements the LC-MS/MS technology and is increasingly being used as a forensic tool for the identification of classes of PFAS. On that point, let's now take a look at the per class methods. Next slide.
I think we have a question, Mr. Oaxaca, from Vice Chair Dr. Olson.
Sure.
Yes, it's real quick, and it's just probably toward me. So you have your non-drinking water matrices that you're looking at or materials. What are they? Is it beyond wastewater, biosolids, and solid waste? What are those those substances?
Yeah, good question. And if I understand the question right, the other types of matrices out there are, for example, groundwater, wastewater, some of the ones you already mentioned, soils, biosolids. It's pretty much everything other than drinking water.
Okay, so where is wastewater on these in this process?
Yeah, that the wastewater would fall into that category of non-drinking water.
Right, and the best method is still the Department of Defense method.
Correct. So if you want to go back one more slide, please. Or two more. Yeah, so this slide here would be applicable to the wastewater matrix. And for that, as I mentioned, laboratories are using the SPE and as well as the LC-MS/MS technology. But because there are no methods right now for wastewater and other matrices, the laboratories have modified them and to create the consistency and reliability that's needed for regulatory use, the DoD criteria provides those bookends to ensure that the data that is being generated meets a certain level of quality.
So most of the labs have developed special sort of tweaks for their particular substance that they're analyzing. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes, ma'am. In a sense, that's correct.
In a sense. Well, what sense is it not correct? I'm sorry.
Well, just in that, when they're tweaking it, you know, that we typically would call that a modification to the method.
Uh-huh.
And the idea here or the goal is really to identify these PFAS compounds or at least increase or improve the number of compounds that can be detected. The modifications also address interferences because of the complex matrix. So it has multiple different reasons for why they're wanting to modify the method.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Yes, ma'am. So as I mentioned, we're going to switch kind of gears now and look at the landscape of methods, you know, from a per class view. And as you may recall, you know, I talked about when we were talking about per class methods, these are methods that can be thought of as a non-targeted analysis approach. And they're really designed to look at the total amount of PFAS compounds in a sample. This is an approach that is gaining lots of attention, not only here in California, but around the world. The two methods that I'm going to highlight today are the total oxidizable precursor, or TOF assay, and the total organic fluorine, or TOF assay. The TOF assay is considered to provide an estimate of the current and potential concentration of PFAS in a sample. The sample is oxidized and the compounds are transformed through that oxidation into their precursors, which allows us to potentially see more of the PFAS that was available in the sample. So again, here the difference here is that instead of looking at individual compounds, the analysis looks at the total concentration. The two downsides that regulatory agencies should consider when thinking about using this approach is that it's likely that some of the PFAS will remain undetected. In other words, it doesn't all fully become oxidized or transferred to the precursors, and in some cases, additional interferences may show up. And so an additional downside is that the quality guidelines that are really needed to provide a minimum level of quality and comparability still need to be developed for these types of methods. Again, that's not to downplay or to downgrade the use of this. It's just, again, part of the whole fit for purpose and risk that the regulatory agencies have to weigh. There are certainly some upsides to using this, but it's really up to the regulatory agencies to determine what approach to take. For the total organic fluorine assay, the goal here is to determine the total presence of organic fluorine. And this approach has been designed to be used in conjunction with other quantitative methods. As with the total oxidizable precursor assay, the downside with total organic fluorine assay is that additional need for standardized quality guidelines when using this approach. Ultimately, the choice to take this approach, again, comes down to the needs of the regulatory agencies. If that is a direction that the state board or regional board would like to go in, ELAP is ready to accredit laboratories for these methods. So this wraps up the technical aspects of the presentation, and I'll now close with a summary of ELAP's perspective on PFAS testing and highlight the key takeaways from this presentation. Next slide. So here at ELAP, we see ourselves as a bridge between regulatory science and laboratory science. We have a seat on the Water Board's PFAS strategy team, and we provide direct support and technical recommendations on a regular basis. We are advocates for data quality, and when it comes to new and innovative approaches to PFAS, we commend and support the scientific community's efforts to meet the needs for environmental protection. In the end, our goal is that the data that is used by the state and regional boards, as well as all of our other regulatory agency partners, will be of the highest quality and is reliable for its intended use. Next slide. As I mentioned, I'm going to close with three key takeaways. First, I hope that the point was made that the analytical methodologies are still evolving. Unfortunately, ELAP doesn't necessarily have control over that. Second, the analytical methods and detection strategies at this time are really meant to be complementary rather than being used in an exclusive way. And lastly, I'm going to echo what I hear most often at PFAS conferences and webinars, or when I talk to leaders in the industry, and that is success will be achieved through regulatory and laboratory partnerships. This concludes the presentation. Thank you again for your attention and for giving me the opportunity to present today. I will now turn it back over to Christine for any last comments, or we can open the floor for questions.
Do we have any questions for Mr. Oaxaca or Ms. Sotelo?
I'm sorry, Celeste, I have Dr. one. Sorry. So it's just a real, this is just a real quick one. And you may not, this may not be the right part of the presentation. But what are the costs? What's the cost of these tests? Is it, if it should be asked later on, I'm fine to hold the question.
Can you clarify, are you talking about the cost per sample to analyze a sample?
Right, and you went over one that did 18 compounds and one that did 25, and then I guess some that do 30 and a few now are doing 70. So what level would, I mean, is it all negotiated what level you need to analyze for your area, or is it better to start with this TOF methodology and then go into the others?
So I'll unpack that a little bit. I think I heard a few questions. First, with regards to the cost of analysis, mm-hmm. Those are set by the laboratories. Without putting my foot in my mouth here, I'm going to just go out on a limb and saying, the cost for the analysis could probably typically range from anywhere, I would say, probably $300 to $500 per sample. So that's just, and again, that's determined by each of the laboratories that are providing the analysis. Now you got to take into account that, again, these are pretty highly sophisticated instruments. They require a lot of supplies and equipment to maintain, and then as well as needing qualified staff and analysts who are capable of interpreting and synthesizing the data, the raw data that comes out of these instruments, and translating that into results that the regulatory agencies can then use. Second, to kind of touch on the other part of your question, as far as which method to start with or which method to use, that again, that would be a regulatory decision that would be made by, for example, DWQ or DDW. So I'll maybe punt that one to them, to those on the panel right now. But okay. Before I do that, I wanted to just also kind of add one more part to this answer, in that the, for example, with the drinking water methods, you know, I mentioned that they can test for up to 18 compounds using 537.1, or up to 25 using method EPA method 533. And those are just standard, that's standard. So when you submit a sample, you're going to get those results if they're there, or if they're detectable. In other words, if they're not non-detect, you would get a result for those, that list of 18 compounds. It's just it's a packaged kind of thing where you get that, the whole set of 18 or the whole set of 25.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Any other questions for Mr. Oaxaca or Ms. Sotelo? Do we have any questions from the public, Mr. Mitchell?
Board Chair, we do have another part to this presentation if we wanted to hold off on public comments to the very end.
Okay, let's continue then. Thank you.
All All right, this is Megan Plumley speaking. Can everyone hear me and see me?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Excellent. All right, so today I'm going to give you, or first I should say good afternoon. I think it almost is in 1 minute, members of the board. Today I'm going to give you a brief overview of the work we're doing at Orange County Water District to address PFAS that occurs in our groundwater, which is our key drinking water source for the area. So this is a significant issue for us. Next slide. So I'll give some quick background on our treatment study to look at technologies to remove PFAS from our groundwater and show you some of the data and results from the pilot and lab components of that testing. And we're now referring this work as phase one work, since now we would like to embark on a second phase to look at additional technologies piloting. So that's our phase two that's just getting underway. Next slide. So a little bit of background on what we do and the PFAS impact. Some of this was mentioned in the biography that was provided for me earlier. So we are a groundwater wholesaler. We serve 19 different water retailers and water districts. So this map here shows where we're located in Orange County, and the blue shaded region is the area that we manage. So it's the north and central portions of Orange County. And you can see the Santa Ana River flowing through there, and we have recharge facilities, which are spreading ponds that we recharge the groundwater supply with river water. We also operate a large potable reuse advanced water purification facility. I should quickly mention that PFAS is not a concern for that facility, given that we use reverse osmosis. So the PFAS is removed from that portion of our drinking water supply, and we manage a seawater intrusion barrier. So we have a lot of responsibilities. We're essentially responsible for the quality and quantity of this local groundwater supply that provides 77% of the drinking water supply for North and Central Orange County. Unfortunately, we do have PFAS detected in certain portions of the aquifer, which is impacting certain drinking water production wells. Those wells are owned and operated by the water retailers. And you can see I listed at the top there the state DEW response levels for drinking water for PFOA and PFOS. So in the case of PFOA, we do have some locations with concentrations of PFOA above that 10 nanogram per liter response level. So because of that, we are working with water retailers to address this issue and restore our local drinking water supply. So we're supporting the design and the construction of PFAS treatment systems for 10 different impacted water retailers. We're actually funding 100% of the capital costs ourselves, and then 50% share with the water retailers up to a certain amount for the O&M ongoing costs. And our goal is to bring these treatment systems online within 1 to 3 years. So for some of these impacted water retailers and cities, construction has already started. Next slide. So this is not an image of one of our sites because the construction's not done yet, but it gives you a sense for what these big steel vessels look like that hold adsorption products that remove the PFAS from the water. So our overall objective is, of course, to meet California's PFAS water quality guidelines to ensure water quality and promote public health. Our specific treatment study objectives have been to determine which of these adsorbents might best remove PFAS for our local water quality and for the best value, recognizing each of these adsorbents has a different cost. So the key, the sort of the main two categories of adsorbents that are available are granular activated carbon, or GAC, or ion exchange resins. But there's also new adsorbents coming out which don't necessarily fall into those two categories. So here I refer to those as alternative adsorbents. We've also called them novel adsorbents in our project. But there's also new products coming out, for example, for ion exchange. So new adsorbents can be developed and emerge within each of these categories. So from a testing perspective, it means that there's always more adsorbents that you could potentially evaluate and understand whether it might be a better fit for your project or perhaps a more attractive cost. Next slide. So for our specific project, we began the lab and pilot testing work back in December of 2019 to evaluate these different adsorbents. And we hired Jacobs as our engineering consultant to perform the overall treatment study, which included a number of different components. And they subcontracted to Battelle as the laboratory to complete the laboratory testing component of the work. But for the pilot scale portion, OCWD staff are operating, managing that system, and analyzing those samples from our in-house ELAP accredited laboratory using the method that was just mentioned in the previous presentation, the first one that was the drinking water targeted method that has 18 different compounds, method 537.1. So we are accredited for this method within our in-house laboratory, and that's what we're using for the pilot study as well. Battelle used in their in-house laboratory that same method for the laboratory analysis. Next slide. So folks don't always realize exactly what these adsorbents look like. So we have some photographs here. GAC has that black color. So you can see it's like a granular material. Ion exchange is more like little beads, little spherical beads of a variety of kind of shades of yellow and orangish and white from what I've seen. The alternative adsorbents are also these granular materials, kind of rocky like the GAC and of all types of colors. So you essentially pour these media into a pilot system or a full-scale treatment system, and then water filters through it. Next slide. So for our testing, we actually ended up with a pretty big list of different adsorbents. A more typical water agency lab or pilot study that's evaluating adsorbents, whether it's for PFAS or some other type of organic contaminant or inorganic being removed, but it might look at 2 to 4 different adsorbents. Once Jacobs completed their market survey of kind of what was out there and what the different manufacturers and vendors were promoting as being, you know, suitable for PFAS, we ended up with kind of a longer list, and we decided to go ahead and evaluate essentially everything, casting a wide net just on the off chance that perhaps that, you know, 14th adsorbent would be the best one for our project. So it was quite involved. So 8 different GAC products, 4 different ion exchange resins, and a couple different alternative adsorbents. I often get asked about, you know, disposal or whether these can be regenerated. It really depends on the different adsorbents. So for GAC, as a general rule, yes, that can be reactivated and then reused. So for example, in the drinking water space, we can do custom batch reactivation where the vendor can, so basically you filter the water, right? You remove PFAS, but eventually the adsorbent becomes exhausted. It can no longer remove the PFAS, it's spent, but then the manufacturer or the vendor can come and retrieve it, take it away, reactivate it through a high temperature process, and bring it back to you to reuse, and the process begins again. And not every GAC supplier is able to offer that service, so it varies. So you might have to find a third party to take away your GAC and reactivate it and bring it back to you. For ion exchange, the 4 adsorbents that we looked at, these all happen to be single-use products, so they would need to be disposed of after use. That's done through either hauling it away to an appropriate landfill or perhaps incineration. So our water retailers are largely leaning towards the ion exchange over the GAC and have to make that decision as to how it will be disposed of. And then the alternative adsorbents just depend on the case. In this particular 2 I show here, the Cyclopure Dexsorb product, that company is working on a regeneration option. So that's potentially able to be regenerated and reused, whereas the Fluorosorb is not. It's more like it's a single use, so dispose of it once it's spent. So for our overall study, we piloted all of these technologies, but for the laboratory testing, which is analogous to the pilot, but much smaller scale to look at the flow through, you know, ability of these products to remove PFAS, we did not include ion exchange simply because the particular standardized RSSCT rapid small scale column testing method is really not suitable for ion exchange. Next slide. This is a photograph of the inside of our pilot building. You can see the GAC skids on the left. You can see the black color showing through those transparent columns. And in the back there, further away, you can't really see the ion exchange smaller columns that also houses the novel or alternative adsorbents. So as far as overall status, we completed all the laboratory small scale column testing, as well as recently the pilot scale testing. So this is all being rolled into an overall final project report being completed by Jacobs that we expect very soon. But since we have such an aggressive timeline and all of the water retailers need to, you know, put treatment systems online, we've been developing the information as we go and providing the findings to the different water retailers. But of course, it'll all be packaged very nicely into a final report at the end. We are still continuing to sample our pilot just because it takes quite a long time for the best performing adsorbents to show more complete breakthrough or reach more complete exhaustion, and we'd like to document that. So we are continuing to sample our pilot, but ultimately we do have enough information as of January to issue findings that support selection of adsorbents for our overall project. Next slide, please. So a little peek at some of the data. We're essentially developing breakthrough curves for either the pilot scale or the laboratory scale. So the x-axis, this data here is pilot data. The x-axis is time in months, which can also be plotted in terms of number of bed volumes of water treated. So for those familiar with adsorption science, that's often a way that folks like to look at the data. And then the y-axis is the concentration, in this case of PFOA, that's in the treated effluent. So we have similar plots for different PFAS that we measured. So initially, if you look at, for example, the chart on the left, the bituminous GAC products, of which there were four different types shown as the colored lines there, initially you see non-detect for all products. So that's expected. You're filtering the water, you're getting non-detect of PFOA in the effluent. But over time, PFOA begins to break through, and it will eventually approach and meet your influent concentration of PFOA, which is shown as the horizontal dashed black line. And that would represent 100% exhaustion. So that's the kind of curve we're trying to develop, because this data can then be put into models and be used to compare the adsorbents to one another and to predict what the full scale performance would be, which mainly what you want to know is how long will the media last at full scale before you have to empty those big still tanks and replace with new fresh media. So you can see some example results for the bituminous GAC products on the left, the ion exchange products in the middle there, and one of the alternative adsorbents on the right-hand side in purple. So we found that all adsorbents can successfully remove PFAS. You always see that initial non-detect. So it's really just a question of how quickly it begins to break through. And then once it does break through, how rapid or steep is that advance? So we want to see later breakthrough and a flatter or less steep advance of that breakthrough, right? That's a longer lasting adsorbent, which will mean replacing the adsorbent less frequently and lower O&M costs. So the testing was really valuable because you can already see from these data here that within each category, like look, for example, at ion exchange, certain adsorbents emerge as superior. So you can see the pink, the product shown in pink, which is the Evoqua PSR2 Plus resin. In our case, for our water, lasted much longer. That's actually quite a big difference there than the other three. But I do want to point out that local testing is important. I've seen data from a site in Colorado where it was flipped, like the PSR2 Plus didn't perform as well, and one of the other products we looked at performed better for them. So just want to sort of offer the disclaimer that, you know, pilot or lab data from one particular other entity's study is not necessarily the same performance you'll see for your water supply. So this kind of localized site-specific testing is needed. Next slide. A little more detail, bituminous GACs did tend to perform better than the non-bituminous category, which I don't show here just for brevity. Within the bituminous GACs, we did see good performance of the Calgon F400, but all three of the bituminous GACs performed pretty similarly over the long term. So there's some good options for our water retailers who are interested in selecting a long-lasting GAC adsorbent. For the water retailers preferring ion exchange, we did see, as I mentioned, that the PSR2 Plus showed later initial breakthrough and the lowest sustained effluent PFOA concentration. We were actually really impressed by the results. We consider them very encouraging for the novel or alternative adsorbent known as Setco Fluorosorb 200, which is specifically marketed for PFAS. It's the purple colored product plotted there. Showed really late breakthrough and very low sustained PFOA effluent concentration. It's the reason we have to keep running our pilot forever and ever longer than we ever thought. So it's, you know, it's this ironic situation where the better the adsorbent, you know, works for you, the longer and many more months that you're spending running your pilot to develop this breakthrough curve and get the data. Next slide. This is a rendering of the system that's actually being constructed now for the city of Fullerton. At this particular well site, they chose ion exchange. So in support of this work, we asked for bids from the for the initial IX resin media fill for this and another PFAS treatment system. So we requested bids from the top three performing ion exchange products as based on the data from our pilot. And based on the bid pricing and the pilot performance, the Evoqua PSR2 Plus resin was selected for these systems, which includes the one pictured here. Next slide. And I did mention we had laboratory data as well. I spent more time talking about our pilot, but I just want to mention the laboratory component. We consider it really complementary to the pilot data. Because lab testing takes less time than piloting, you can do it for more water. So that's exactly what we did. So on the x-axis, you can see all these different wells that we tested. We selected representative wells from different impacted water agencies, except and the first one there is our water that fed the pilot. And we completed this small scale column. So it's a tiny mini version of the pilot column. And it's just for the GAC products. And this slide, is main takeaway here is the different performance depending on the city. So it shows how the local water quality can influence things. The primary y-axis on the left is the volume of water. Well, excuse me, I'll say first, this laboratory data then has to be converted to a full scale projection. And that's what's been done here. So the y-axis is the projection of how much water can be treated before the breakthrough reaches a more significant point, which is 60% of the influent concentration. And that's the point by which we think the media would likely have to be changed out. And so the secondary y-axis converts that to time. So these systems run for a long time, many months before the GAC potentially needs to be changed, but it varies a lot by site. So for example, Santa Ana, we expect a shorter GAC life, so higher O&M costs if they were to select GAC compared to some of the other locations. And that's essentially driven by the total organic carbon content of the water and the nature of that TOC. If it's particularly sticky, it's going to bind up to the GAC and basically compete for sorption sites with compete with PFAS. So that's why you see a shorter life when there's more TOC or more of kind of a sticky TOC. Next slide. So as far as plans for phase two, as I mentioned, new adsorbents continued to be introduced into the market for PFAS. So while our media that we tested in phase one can be selected and utilized by our water retailers in the near term, they could consider other adsorbents in the future as part of their routine, which is pretty periodic, media replacements. When the media is exhausted, they don't necessarily have to refill the vessels with the same media they had before, as long as the new media is deemed to be compatible with those steel vessels, which many of them would be. So we've already identified a number of products we'd like to test, and we're currently preparing for that, starting that phase two pilot. And I think that's my last slide. Next slide. Yes, it is. All right, so with that, I can take any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Plumlee. Any questions for Ms. Plumlee? Dr. Olson.
Sorry, okay. So Orange County always does great work, so I want to compliment you on your work. I did just have two questions. One is, so you've done this for Fullerton. I thought also you'd done it for Yorba Linda.
That's right.
Okay. So I heard that the cost for the Yorba Linda infrastructure was quite expensive, but they might have quoted, now that I'm hearing you're doing it for all of the ones that need it, what is the cost of putting that infrastructure together?
It's very site specific. So I can't give you, the numbers change so much depending on the location.
What can you do?
I don't know the specifics of Yorba Linda, but.
I don't care about Yorba Linda. I just, okay. Can you give me the low and the high?
Sure. So as part of Jacob's evaluation, they've taken our lab and pilot data and have developed cost estimates. And we decided to do this in a generalized way, recognizing that there are site-specific differences city by city. So in parallel with our sort of generic cost estimate that we've used to compare GAC to ion exchange to the alternative adsorbents, for a generic theoretical 3,000 GPM well, we're also developing site-specific cost estimates. So I think the generic sort of theoretical case might be of most interest to you. It's still draft, but for example, I'm looking at some of the numbers here. We roll the capital and the O&M costs into what's called a unit cost, so dollars per acre foot. And GAC and ion exchange can come out. One can be higher or lower than the other depending on the specific project, right? So they're close enough that you have to do the cost analysis to see what might be more cost effective. So in our case, looking at, you know, our performance that we see for this better performing GAC compared to like better performing ion exchange compared to better performing alternative adsorbents. So we take those longer lasting cases. Our GAC costs are coming out a little higher, more like around $260 to $290 per acre foot for treatment, capital plus O&M. So we're talking about a significant cost there because the cost of groundwater in Orange County is around $500 an acre foot that the water retailers pay. So this is a significant, you know, cost burden to add to groundwater. But by comparison, for our study, it worked out the ion exchange should be lower than that, maybe in the $150 to $190 per acre foot range. And the novel adsorbent Fluorosorb could be around, could be similar or a little lower than ion exchange. That's why that result was so encouraging. And it's because it has kind of the small footprint the ion exchange would have, which gives ion exchange its smaller capital costs relative to GAC. But ion exchange tends to have a higher O&M cost because it's more expensive per pound. But this Seco Fluorosorb has a cost per pound that's more similar to a GAC. So it seems to offer the small footprint and therefore smaller capital cost of the GAC while with also the smaller O&M cost like IX. But those numbers aren't totally final yet. And it's just a theoretical estimate for a generic well case.
So was that, I'm sorry, but you told me the data you showed was the PSR2, I think.
The ion exchange.
Was that good? Is that an alternative or an ion exchange?
The Evoqua PSR2 Plus is an ion exchange product. So that was the pink line in that center plot that I showed earlier.
Oh, you had one to the right. What was it? The one to the far right had the
The knob alternative.
Yeah.
That's right. And that one is the Setco Fluorosorb product. Yeah, sorry, there's a lot of lingo. So when I say kind of encouraging result where lower capital, maybe lower O&M, that is that purple data that was to the right. That's the Seco Fluorosorb product.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then I just had one other question. So I don't know if you've identified the water quality that make, because you just showed us the GAC, and but is does TDS impact it, or do you know the water quality constituents that might affect the lifetime of the absorbent or ion exchange or whatever?
Yes. So we had a list of water quality constituents that are known to potentially affect GAC versus a different list for ion exchange. Mm-hmm. And so we did include as part of our sampling program those constituents because we wanted to obviously generally understand that. So with GAC, the most important thing is really the TOC. Mm-hmm. Not so much the TDS. And we did find that we saw what others have seen, that the higher the TOC, the shorter the GAC life. Ion exchange is less influenced by TOC, but still influenced by it. So that's important as well. But it can be impacted by certain anions in the water. So sulfate, for example. So we tracked that. And with the alternative adsorbents, I'd say it's less clear because they're newer. We measured all the same things. And what was really interesting about both of the alternative adsorbents was they didn't really remove TOC from the water the same way GAC did quite a bit. And ion exchange does a little bit. So it supports that there's less competition because if you're not removing other TOC, you're not competing with PFAS. So you're really getting the sort of targeted selective PFAS removal with the use of these particular two alternative adsorbents.
Looking ahead, do you anticipate that there'll have to be two different types of absorbent used, or you think you'll be able to do it with just one?
I think we'll be able to do it with just one. And conventionally, that's how it's done because you have a lead bed and you have a lag bed in series, and it's the same adsorbent in both. So it's really a backup to the first bed, as opposed to putting different ones in different vessels. Yeah.
Okay, great. And then the at the disposal cost. So if you can regenerate it, it costs quite a bit to regenerate it. And I don't know for GAC, is it cheaper to dispose of it or cheaper to regenerate it? And then what is the cost of disposal?
Right. So those are the exact evaluations that have to be done to really make some engineering decisions as far as what's going to be more cost effective. I was really interested to learn that when you receive back the reactivated GAC, it's less. So the virgin GAC will cost a certain amount per pound, but the reactivated GAC might be half that cost. So it's absolutely of economic interest to receive the reactivated product back. So it's nice that you're reusing it. It's not going to a landfill, so it sounds more sustainable in that regard, but it's also costing you less. But not every manufacturer of GAC offers that service. For example, Evoqua and Calgon do. If you purchased a GAC from another party, you might need to then identify a third party to reactivate it and bring it back to you. So, you know, those costs would have to be evaluated.
Could it be reactivated in the state, or would it have to go somewhere else, or they have closed?
Good question. Yeah.
Weeds for the. I'll get in touch with you. I have lots of questions.
Okay, sure.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Well, this has been a fascinating presentation. I mean, PFAS is such a major concern for all of, and everywhere we look, we really need to get a handle on it. I really appreciate the work that you're doing. Orange County Water District Laboratory is well known for being in the forefront and doing excellent work. The costs, however, need to come down. It's just too expensive. And, you know, we do see generally when people adopt new practices, costs do go down over time. But even the best case is just a huge increase. And we increasingly see our communities, you know, huge percentage of our communities who really cannot afford to pay any incremental increased costs for drinking water. It really kind of begs us to look at, do we need to start envisioning a parallel system where you have drinking water that's relatively expensive, that is plumbed only for drinking water, and then all other potable water or water that's used for everything besides drinking that would be of a lower quality and therefore less expensive. I mean, much of the world does that, but we may be approaching a time where we just can deliver high quality water, but at a cost people really cannot absorb. It's a major dilemma, but thank you for this work. We do have one more agenda item and we have a closed session. Before we do that, Roger, do we have from the public?
Yeah, thank you very much. So just as a quick reminder, I'll go ahead and poll the public to see if anybody wishes to speak. If you do wish to speak, please virtually raise your hand now in Zoom using the raise hand function. Or if you're on your phone, go ahead and press *9 now. Or Chair Cantu, I'm not seeing any hands being raised at this time.
Okay, you've got to be quick draw McGraw to get your hand up fast enough, it seems. But given that there's none, I want to thank you all for your presentation, Mr. Oaxaca and Ms. Sotelo and Orange County, Ms. Plumlee, and our staff. This is something we are looking forward to hearing more updates and hopefully progress as we move forward. This has been very interesting, and it's something that addresses a huge challenge that we have before us. So thank you for your good work and for the time you spent with us today. Our next agenda item is, we're on number 5, board members' requests. And this is the time and place where we invite board members to share what future agenda items they would like our staff to look at. Do we have any? Dr. Arbanal.
The name's Henry.
Okay, Henry.
And I prefer to be called that. Yes, I had a chance meeting with a resident of Lake San Marcos and discovered his and his homeowners association's distinct frustration with the molasses-like implementation of improvements to the lake. I would like to hear from the principals, whom we've heard from in the past, and I would like to invite the members of the public who actually live there to address the water board. I know they can if they want, but the truth is, the person I spoke to had no idea that there is a water board or what it does. So perhaps we can reach out.
Okay, that's been a problem that's been around for decades and would be really nice to make some progress on it. I know the staff has been
working on it. I was kind of hoping that it wouldn't be around for another decade or two. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? Hearing none, we will adjourn to closed session. We'll take a 5-minute break and then join on closed session in 5 minutes on Teams. And Mr. Vu, can you announce what we will be doing in closed session?
Thank you, Chair Cantu. The board will be meeting in closed session today to discuss item number 6I on the agenda. And that item is regards to the litigation for people of the state of California versus the International Boundary and Water Commission.
Could I ask Christina Blank if she could just send us all the Teams thing again? I don't know how hard that is, but just to make, oh, I see Eric was this. I mean, it gets lost in our mail and then
it's on its way.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Christina.
And Mr. Anderson, do you have anything else to share, or is that your question? Very good. Okay, I have 12:31, so let's meet at 12:36 and Teams. Thank you.
Hi, we're recording and broadcasting. The meeting is yours.
Thank you. The Regional Water Quality Control Board met in closed session to discuss the litigation as announced, and no action was taken. Thank you very much. This concludes our agenda for April the 14th.